with Mr. Auditor General. We're happy to have you with us today, as is always the case. When we are with you, it is the only time that our blood pressures remain steady, because we have no contestation on issues. But our engagement with you is actually a preparatory process to empower us to be able to do our work. And this is a ritual we, if one may call it, we engage in every year once you have done your work in line with the provisions of the Public Finance Management Act, requiring that 6 months after the end of the financial year, annual reports together with your audit opinion must be submitted to Parliament. And once that is done, our work as this committee kicks off. But we always benefit from this engagement, because not only does it give more meaning to what we read in the book submitted to Parliament, but it also enables us to have a sense, a broad overview of where we're at as a country in terms of how we manage the resources that we have. Resources that that are not in abundance. We don't have a budget surplus in the country. If anything, borrowing is at levels that we cannot ignore. Now, in that situation, therefore, it means the first thing and most critical thing is how do we manage the precious resources that we have. SARS does a very good job to collect the taxes and hand them over to the state. And you come in and say, how did the state manage those resources handed to them by SARS? So, and I think that as a committee, Auditor General, we have resolved a couple of weeks ago in our strat plan review session that, having found our rhythm, we want to hold departments on a short leash to ensure that we don't merely go through the ritual of having meetings and having meaningless explanations. That does not impact on how things are done, and a substantive change in the things that you see when you go into departments. So I would want to contextualize the engagement in that particular context. Just to also lastly add to you that yesterday we had an engagement with the departments that by last week Tuesday, when we took the decision, had not yet submitted to Parliament their annual reports. Some had submitted day before yesterday, so when we met them, they had submitted the day before. We're aware that some have not yet submitted. And the reason we took that decision to engage with them was because we felt it was unprecedented that we had almost four departments missing their deadlines, and some other entities, and we felt we needed to engage with them and say we cannot allow that to take root where it becomes normal. I mean, in the past we would have one department, Home Affairs, when we knew it was in trouble, or public works when we knew it was in trouble. But to just, out of the blue, have four departments that have not submitted, we felt this was unprecedented and it needed to be it needed to be tackled head on right now. We had our engagement, we had a sense of what is happening from what they told us, but we also had a sense that some of these officials were very economical with the truth in terms of exactly what the issues are. But what they point out to, it's an administrative leadership that seem to have issues with accountability. It's almost like people would be happy to just work, have money, and just work. Do things the way they would like to. Comrades, as we agreed yesterday, we wrote to the Minister of Environmental Affairs and the department. Tombi, did I get it right that they would prefer to come on Wednesday? Yeah, so the administration has agreed that they would rather come on Wednesday because Tuesday they already had a commitment. But we have not yet heard any word from the minister because I made it clear that the prerogative of departments appearing before SCOPA cannot be hers. It's ours. If we have invited them, if they are not going to come, it should be by agreement with us, not by their unilateral decision and seeking to decide for us when and how we can call them. So I think that's the context, AG. Other than that, I think we're in your hands. You can take us through, and as usual, where we feel there is need for further clarity, I think we'll engage as we always do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, for those welcoming remarks. I can only say that your sentiments that you have expressed are indeed what we had in mind and what we also thought we will share with yourselves today. So we are indeed very happy that you allowed us the opportunity, as you always do, that we share the overall audit outcomes as you are also embarking on doing your oversight work. And that is why we have here with us the National Leader for Audit Services, who is responsible for coordinating all of this audit effort across the different provinces. Barry Wheeler alongside, a corporate executive who is also responsible for some of the portfolios that we are going to be sharing with you here. Some of the corporate executives are not here today, but we will represent them. The matter that you touched on, Chair, I'm glad that you did the way you did handle it, pertaining to outstanding audits. I think the issue of outstanding audits, much as you have engaged with it yesterday, I agree that it requires to remain on the agenda, because these many outstanding audits manifest themselves in a number of ways. They are an indication of perhaps the emergence of what was not there before, where people were giving a blind eye to audit matters and not giving attention. There's that category when it comes to these outstanding audits. And there's also a category of people who just did not do their work and think that surfacing a finding is going to put them on the table. And of course, there are also those that make commitments without the intention to meet them. And when the crunch time comes, because the reporting date for the PFNMA, unfortunately, is regulated to the 30th of July. So if they don't get their way, regardless of the fact that they were aware throughout the year these were the contentious issues that required attention by them directly, and I think sometimes they refuse to acknowledge that they dropped the ball and now want to make the audit the excuse in many ways, suggesting that the auditors are shifting the goalposts, when in fact there was no shifting of the goalposts. All that there was just a mere dereliction of duty on the part of those that did not come to the party and face the audit scrutiny. So I agree that it is indeed a matter that needs to be nipped in the bud, as you said, as quickly as possible, so that all of them can come forward to account. Let's rather deal with what the audit outcome is than to deal with all other peripheral issues that are an indication of work not being done where it's supposed to be. Coming to the audit outcomes, Chair, as I wrap up that part, we certainly going to go through this slide economically. And I guess if I skip certain areas, I will assume that, especially for those slides that have got a lot of narrative, I'm going to try and spend less time because what we have written there is possibly clear. And if it's not clear, we'll probably pick up questions from directly if there's anything that we still need to clarify. But I'll try and spend more time on the one that's got the graphics. And there's a couple of parts to this presentation, Chair, as well. The one part that I'm going to deal with up front is to share the overall audit outcomes for all national departments and entities together with the departments in all the 9 provinces as we have audited them. So we're basically going to share audit outcomes as we have them on page 3 of the slides in front of us, which cover 169 departments in total, as well as the audit outcomes of 315 public entities across provinces and nationally. So that is a full account that we're going to be dealing with as the first part of the presentation. And then, Chair, we will also take you through some of the work that we've done in addition to the signing off of financial statements as we have them in the PFMA. If you look at our slide presentation, and I'm sure that some members might take an interest while we go through the other bit to quickly peek through these ones. If you look from page 34, maybe just on page 34, and page 30, up to page 37, we will be giving an update on part of what is going to be in the general report, which is the education sector report. We've done specific work, for example, on education infrastructure, on education districts, the issue of management of school finances, e-education strategy, and all of those ones. These will be part of what will be contained in the general report, because as part of our audit implementation plan, we decided long ago, Chair, as you will remember, that the time has come for us to go deeper into some of the programs so that as the financial management matters are evaluated, there's also a line of sight into how are specific programs and specific sectors that are priority spending areas performing. And we've looked at the issues of TVET infrastructure, skills development, and so on. So there will be a detailed education sector report that will accompany the general report when we launch it during the time of the launch. Then, Chair, following on that, on page 39, you will see that on page 39, we've also identified specific focus areas with regards to the health sector, so that in addition to the financial management reports that we have evaluated, where we identified a number of issues that I'm going to deal with shortly, we've also honed in on some of the specific areas as far as the performance of the health sector is concerned, the likes of your planning and maintenance of infrastructure within that sector, information technology, use and maintenance of medical equipment. Very interestingly, Chair, if I might just steal a moment on this one, this is one of those areas that is normally covered by our teams within the performance audit environment, where we have medical experts who are part of our team who have got direct technical knowledge about the utilization of things like this medical equipment and how it should be maintained and so on and so forth. So there are sort of lots of interesting insights if one drills down into the health portfolio to see what works, what are the areas that still require to be supported and all that. After that, we've also done a detailed performance audit, Chair, which has been going for quite some time, where we covered the whole area of water and sanitation infrastructure, having picked up from previous reports as well as some inputs that came from different sectors, where we focused on issues of the delivery of infrastructure for water and sanitation across 6 of the 9 provinces. So that performance audit report is undergoing the final stages of its review, and we are hoping that, time permitting, by the end of this month, we will table that report as well after we have tabled the general report. Another performance audit, which is also briefly what I'm going to cover later on in the slides, is with respect to the management of pharmaceuticals, another area within the health budget environment, where we look at issues around the management of pharmaceuticals to ensure that patients received prescribed pharmaceuticals in time. What processes are in place, what disciplines, what management controls have been put in place in different districts where all of this work is happening, so that we can begin to complement the work that is happening within the health portfolio. So those are some of the highlights, Chair, which I thought I'll just deal with up front. There's been an issue also that has popped up over time in regards to the audits that are done by firms outside of the audit office. We'll also share some insights in respect of what we've been doing in that area, and that is largely covered around page 46 to page 47 and 48. And then lastly, Chair, I will also cover another development which I think a lot of the members on the oversight will be familiar with, which is what is set out on page 49. What is on page 49 is an enhancement that we are introducing. We are now at a pilot stage in terms of introducing this enhancement, what we call the status of records review. It's a key control engagement that is a growth or a development from what we had started a number of years ago, where we had a dashboard which shows which entities or departments are red, yellow, or green. But what we are doing here in terms of this status of records review, we are undertaking a process where we want on a regular basis, as quarterly or second at the end of a second quarter, to engage with the status of accounting records review as part of our independent assessment of the maintenance of accounting records prior to the financial year end. I'll deal with the detail of that as well when I get to that part. So those are the things, Chair, as I go through the presentation, that we must just keep in mind, so that if there are any questions that arise as I go through this, at least we know that we will possibly cover it there. If not, we'll deal with it in this stage when we deal with the questions. If I start with the PFMA audit outcomes, Chair, on page 3, as I said, and perhaps what is set out on page 3 is the comparative over the last 3 years in terms of how each of the departments and entities have performed after we have completed the audits. It's clear that there's fairly static movement if one looks at the departments overall. One notable fact is that as far as the unqualified with no findings, the green, is concerned, the percentage is starting to decline from where it was in the previous year, comparing 2014 to 2015. And also the extent of the entities that have been unqualified with findings, as well as the qualified ones, seem to be stuck almost at the same levels. It's almost like a changing of the decks, as it were. There are those that improve and there are those that regress. But if you look at the overall performance, there's no real shift, in essence, if one looks at the departments. Alongside, the entities seem to have made a significant strides in strengthening their control environment, as shown by the growing number of clean audits as far as the public entities are concerned. So there is certainly some improvement in that area, and I'll deal with some of the attributable reasons that we've picked up which support that improvement. But overall, as far as they are concerned as well, the numbers that are still unqualified with findings, as well as the ones that are qualified, remain stuck at high numbers. This, Chair, if one looks at the outstanding audits, which is the blue, this is where the bulk of these pushbacks were coming from a number of these public entities, many of them contesting issues that were technically dealt with way in advance, but some of them were really refusing to open up to scrutiny, despite the fact that they were alerted to the issues that will be required on the audit. So there's also another part to this, Chair, which was merely refusal to accept the fact that there were deviations in a number of areas as determined through the supply chain management systems. And I think our team stood their ground and felt that this is what it is and we'll take it wherever it has to go. And as a result of that, many of them had also threatened to take court action to contest the audit outcomes and stuff like that. And we said, well, if that's the path you want to choose, ours is to sign off on the financial statements and we'll take it as it comes. But none of that has transpired yet, but those were some of the threats. It has been a difficult one, Chair. I must say our teams have expressed themselves in areas where this was concentrated, and we have addressed it as well as a starting point to say that it will be unhealthy for an audit to persist in an environment where there are contestations that are sometimes extraordinary. And I think that we accept that an audit is based on judgment, and if somebody's judgment is contested, there are limits to which the issues that are on the table can be countenanced between the parties. So, but we think that it's becoming much clearer that we are focusing on the real issues that matter, and if there are contestations to them, it's good enough because then it promotes the required transparency. If we say that there must be disclosure for certain transactions, we say this because it is in the interest of reporting transparently that we insist that certain levels of disclosure need to be dealt with. And I'll probably cover one area which was quite broad, in broad terms, Chair, systematically. And some people have misinterpreted to mean that we say they must change the basis of their preparation. It's to do with issues that are around the modified cash standards, which requires that there must be certain ways in which certain transactions are treated. In the past, you'll find that if a department was responsible for making transfers to another sphere or to a municipality or to another agency outside of the state, they will do that as a line item in the financial statements, which line item is not more transparent than just transfer. So nobody knows what this transfer is about. It's just a broad term. So the modified cash standard says, once you know what it is that you were transferring this money for, disclose that particular asset which was bought by that entity that was responsible for implementing the thing that you were buying. Because nobody will ever know what this direct transfer is unless you say this is physical assets, this is for current assets, and this was for the building of a crash, for example, in a particular community, so that the control over that asset over time can remain visible through the financial statements rather than just as a transfer. Even if it was budgeted like that, but the point of the matter is that after the expenditure has happened, everybody knows what was physically bought. That's what the disclosure requirement by the modified cash standard is about. So those were some of the contestations, Chair, which we felt that probably it's something that needs to be captured as a need for National Treasury to articulate the reasoning behind some of the adoption of the modified cash standard, because it's something that was confusing to many, and sometimes they refused on the grounds that they don't believe it's the right thing to do. So those were the issues in terms of just contextualizing the contestations. It was not all about not wanting to account, but it was also genuine issues about what is your point of departure. And I think it was the argument between ourselves and them which basically sometimes took far too longer than what it was necessary. Right, if I go into page 4 of this slide presentation, Chair, I think there's one sense if one looks at this slide presentation, which covers the audit outcomes for both national departments as well as the provinces. If you look at the graphic that we've put up here, is that there's certainly a few provinces overall that have effected improvement as depicted by the green facing upwards, being some overall notable improvements in the national portfolios, where the number of clean audits and all are starting to show a positive growth. The Gauteng province, the Northern Cape, NKZN, and the Eastern Cape, among others, have shown overall in terms of their departments as some of the provinces that have contributed a good audit outcomes. The area where there were regressions were largely in the Western Cape, although it still has quite a dominant number of entities and departments that have achieved clean audits. And I think the Gauteng province, as you can see in comparative terms, is starting to to shine the brighter lights in terms of the number of clean audits, although it also has quite a lot of the unqualified with findings still, which have already been taken care of in terms of the commitments in that province. And I think if one looks at the rest of the other ones that have not done well, it's Limpopo, Northwest, and the Free State. And there have been quite a lot of internal control challenges, Chair, in those three provinces. And I think we have engaged with all of them. In fact, Limpopo, we're doing it tomorrow. But the other ones we've all covered in terms of the other nine provinces. Some static position as far as Mpumalanga's outcomes are concerned. Nothing that has moved forward as far as that area is concerned. One of the areas that we also tried to look at in these outcomes, which the general report we will talk to in more detail, Chair, is on page 5, where we cover, just to focus on the budget functions, because if one looks at the estimates of national expenditure and the groupings of the different departments, the way they deliver their different outcomes is normally a combination of a number of entities and departments forming, for example, the agriculture, rural development, and land reform sector. So what we are reflecting on here, if you look at page 5, the first one, we are reflecting on the nine departments and entities that make up that sector, whose outcome are in terms of the 14 outcomes that all of them are driving is comprehensive rural development and land reform. So as an example, if I look at the nine that I'm talking about, Chair, on that agriculture, rural development, and land reform. These are the outcomes of, for example, the clean ones is agriculture, land holding account, the National Agricultural Marketing Council, the Honors the Poor Biological Products, and the rest of them, including the department, are the five, which are unqualified with findings, and Ingonyama Trust Board is the one that's outstanding in terms of the blue there. So those are the groupings in terms of the number of departments and entities. And what we're trying to do in terms of these outcomes in this one is to say those areas that are sector-based in terms of these budgets, how did their individual entities in that particular sector perform in relation to the audit outcomes that we are presenting for this general report. And the same logic goes for the second sector. I won't go to the detail of it. Suffice to say that this is where the likes of your correctional services, your Department of Defense, your Department of Police, your legal aid, your guardian fund, and the rest of them fall under. These are the departments and entities' audit outcomes that we are reflecting on. What is important to note also in terms of them is that quite a lot of them have shown some positive trend in terms of the audit outcomes, as you would see on the year-on-year comparison. The only one that is an exception and that stood out in terms of the greater number of departments and entities we are reporting on is the second last on the bottom, and that is the skills development sector, where its main outcomes is a skilled and capable workforce to support an inclusive growth path. There you've got the likes of education, the likes of your CETAs, the likes of your TVET colleges and all of that. That is the grouping of departments and entities under which that particular category falls. And if you look at their audit outcomes, this is the one that has started to have quite a significant number of entities in particular that have also got large numbers of disclaimers. A lot of these, in terms of the detail that we have, are your TVET colleges in particular. And I think it's worth noting that if you look at the red, there's a dominant number of TVET colleges and so on that have got these disclaimed audit opinions, including the qualifications. And CETAs as well in terms of this. I think the point we are trying to highlight here is that as we look at the financial statements individually in terms of departments and entities, we've also tried to plot the audit outcomes in relation to how the groupings in the sectors are set out in the same estimates of national expenditure on which we are reporting through the financial statements. So that's just for additional insights, Chair, so that even in terms of oversight, if there's any oversight focus that needs to give attention to any particular budget function in the groupings, at least they will have a sense of how the audit outcomes were felt in that area. maybe let's step up to page 7. Taking our focus away from from those groupings and focusing on the high spending budget areas, which is education, health, and public works. We often provide this analysis every year in our audit outcomes, Chair, where we look at the three-year profile in terms of the education, health, and public works. And it's clear that in terms of that grouping, which is the bulk of where the bulk of the expenditure is going, there's no real improvement effected. Instead, they have regressed slightly. However, other departments, which is what is on the other side, if you compare 2015 for this education, health, and public works, as well as other, the other departments have done better in performance purposes in terms of the outcomes as compared to that particular sector. So there is no doubt that this is still one area where the audit outcomes of the bulk of education, if I go straight to page 8, and we can see where the bulk of this is felt. Firstly, on page 8, the only one that is in terms of this sector, which is the education, health, and public works, that has achieved a disclaimer is the education department in Limpopo. The only one. The rest of them are, and of course, the only province that has got clean audits in this sector is Western Cape Education and Public Works. The rest of them, as you can see, are largely unqualified with findings. And let me spend a little bit of time on this one, because this is where the bulk of these departments, the yellow ones, they've largely dealt with their financial management related issues in order to report transparently as far as the accounting rules are concerned. And also it is worth noting that others are still battling, but they do find it right at the end. It's almost like somebody who's got 49.6 and the passing mark is 50. And they really get assisted to make sure that they correct something in order to get the 0.4% in order to get them into the pass range. It's that type of departments, these ones. But also the major issue here is that as far as the compliance with the likes of supply chain management, this is where the bulk of it is. And I think it is apparent if you look at this slide, page 8, as well as you look at the slide previously, the page 7, where we look at where the bulk of the other departments are sitting on page 7. You'll see that a lot of them are sitting in the yellow space. And the yellow space is basically where the bulk of the potential financial losses will be found, because much as you may have corrected the financial statements, but it doesn't fix the fact that you did not comply with the transparent procurement process. It still remains. But the fact that you've put through the correcting entry to fix the financial statements is good enough and acceptable and desirable, but the bottom line is that you have not complied with either reporting accurately on the performance information or complying with supply chain and related matters. And I think I'll maybe develop further insights on that once I come to the slide that deals with irregular expenditure. Chair, just another point to note in terms of these slides on page 10. On page 10, what we are attempting to do here is to look at the percentage, and I think it's just really to get a sense of what proportion of the total budget in terms of these audit outcomes sits where. For example, where we say, if you look at these audit outcomes, the 26% entities, 44 of them, which have achieved clean audits, they were responsible for about 17% of the total budget. That's effectively what this is trying to articulate. And if you look at the unqualified ones, we are saying here 53% of the departments that we are reporting on were largely responsible for about half the budget in essence. And I think that's the kind of focus that we're trying to look at overall now, so that even as we get higher percentages of good audit outcomes, we always have to go back to check how much was it representative of, because it could be that if the bulk of these were education, you would suddenly have, if the bulk of them were education, health, and public works, for example, that were clean, you probably would be having about 70% of that as clean, even though it represents a smaller percentage of entities. So I think it's good to look at that perspective, because that's the reality. The bulk of the expenditure is in health and education in all of these, and as you have seen in the previous slide, the bulk of them are sitting in qualified and unqualified with findings, which is where the bulk of the budget is. (Clears can I step up to actually, I'll leave the narrative slides, and at least if members get a chance to catch up with the narrative, we can deal with the questions when we get to the end. I'll try and get to slide number 14, which looks at the key attributable elements that contribute to the achievement of these audit outcomes, clean audits and unqualified with findings. We're saying the area of leadership is starting to pick up. There's quite a lot of interactions that is taking place with the key people in the departments, as well as with the ministers as well and MECs. I think it demonstrates that a lot more attention is now being given to engaging with audit issues, even though in a number of places this has not yielded good results yet. But what was not there in the past was issues of we're not even engaging on these matters. But I think there's been a ramping up of that, and we will see when we look at further years whether it will translate into the kind of audit outcomes when issues of consequence are taken care of. Because when we assess this, we also assess the extent to which the persistence of negative audit outcomes has been given attention in terms of the consequences, and we're starting to see some shifting of the focus in that area. Some are, and some, and quite a lot still are battling to bring forth those actions. The financial and performance management area is also fairly static in terms of movement if you compare previous year to current year, where we look at the basic instruments and the disciplines that are required. Are the financial management reconciliations being done? Are the issues of vacancies that are outstanding for significantly long periods of time, either at CFO levels or heads of supply chain? And we see here that that area has not really changed much. Books of account are still not kept accurately. As I've said earlier, a lot of the entities that end up with a unqualified position under normal circumstances would have achieved 49.6%. So these are some of the realities that we still find, Chair, in even those that are showing improvements. The governance side, where we reflect on the role that is played by the audit committee, the effort that came from the internal audit, we are seeing a good, solid improvement over the last 3 years, where there's a lot of engagement by oversight and related structures within the departments and entities. Some of the thoughts that we are sharing in terms of the, on page 15, 16, and 17, Chair, and maybe 18, yeah, if you look at all of them combined, here we are just surfacing some of the best practices that we've observed in a number of the departments that have shown improvements over time, and highlighting in our report what is it that can be done to replicate these practices elsewhere. Because it's not things that are recommended in the audits to improve financial management. It's not all things that still need to be researched in terms of how it must be done. There are already departments that are achieving it, that are doing it, and we are really just throwing a spotlight at that. On page 16, I spoke earlier about some concerning trends which we picked up when we engaged with our audit teams, Chair. Before we came to engage with the external stakeholders, we really went out and engage directly with the teams that were responsible for these audits. And many of them, in fact, across the country, have expressed this kind of feedback where they looked at issues of contestations and pushback and so on. Some of those were without substance, as evidenced by the subsequent resolution of the contestations based on the audit outcomes. The audit outcomes remained that which was proposed at the time prior to the legal letters being thrown around and all sorts of things. So it creates for it, it makes for a very unpleasant environment to conduct an audit exercise, because this is an accountability exercise. It's not a threatening court system unless somebody is threatened by staff that they best know. Some of them have not tabled the reports, and I guess we've already spoken about that. There were matters pertaining to slow response. We kind of couched this as slow response. But of course, I think for many it has become no response, because this has been a perennial behavior issue over a number of years. You know, if I don't respond to this audit outcome, and I know that if I don't fix it, nothing is going to happen. Nobody is going to follow up and find out whether I've fixed it or not. I can just make the commitment now so that I can close the book for this year, because next year it's not going to be a bugbear. So this is a major issue in this area of accountability. How do you enforce the implementation of commitments made? I think that's the question that we want oversight to be preoccupied with, so that if people make commitments, these commitments are not made under duress. These are commitments that are made willingly by people who know and agree that a particular control is important. And that's the reason why their audit has failed, is because of the absence of that control. Now, if they don't respond to their commitment, then it means that they were just making the commitment, knowing that there will be no threat, there's no risk, nothing is going to happen if I don't do it. So I think we believe, Chair, if this is left as it is, we'll probably just be throwing the same audit outcomes every year, as it is in fact the reality, that we kind of come to present audit outcomes that are almost exactly the same reason why the things are the way they are. So we are really putting it on the table, Chair, for you to, in addition to what you are doing, focus it more specifically. The other part in regards to audit outcomes of state-owned entities are concerned. This is feedback that we normally solicit largely from the auditors that are responsible for those, but in addition to those is also our own feedback, where we have elevated issues of instability. I think they have been widely reported in a number of areas: instability of leadership in executive positions, instability of leadership in even oversight positions, as well as ineffective leadership practices and poor monitoring and oversight is largely the large number of issues that you will find in dominance among quite a number of the state-owned entities. And then the area of key vacancies in key positions, we've looked at this and said that the target that has been set through the medium-term strategic framework by 2019 is set at 10% in terms of vacancies. But when we focus on the likes of your head of supply chain, your CFO, as well as your heads of department, that percentage is still at between 16 and 20%. So the question is, by the time we get to 2019, how far will we be from the target? I'll skip this particular one and go to slide number 19, the one that looks like a playback. This one is where we deliberately designed it this way so that we can elevate the issue of irregular expenditure properly. Here, Chair, when I was talking about those entities that are still in the yellow, the ones that are in the red, the ones that are in the purple, a lot of them are basically struggling with these issues that are on page 19, where they take different routes to those that are prescribed. And most of the time, unfortunately, the different routes they take somewhere in the bushes, you don't see everything. It's sometimes excuses like, no, but this is an emergency. And I guess the question is, if there was a plan based on what had been approved in the budget, and the plan was that if we are going to implement A, in order to implement A, we must procure something, then the emergency will be less and less. And I think this emergency arises because maybe there's no plan also to say, I will buy something in October in order to build that particular project. These are some of the issues then which result in this irregular expenditure. Ultimately, you find a situation where that project is indeed there, but I think what you are querying in this irregular expenditure, which we'd like more attention given to, is the fact that how do we know that if you had gone the transparent route, you would have ended up paying for far less than what you ended up paying? That's the question. It's not so much about all of this has gone down the drain, no. Hence, we are saying here, look at this tutor. He ultimately gets there where the other guys went the right route. But the bottom line is that certainly, I'm sure if he had a puncher here, he'll probably take longer to get to the other side, because that's really the key issue here. Are we not paying more than what we should be paying for some of these things? Because there's no real justification for the emergency. Sometimes there's no real justification for the extension of what was initially a contract for, let's say, 20,000, but you end up with a total bill in the millions sometimes. as an example. So these are the issues which we are highlighting in supply chain. And we are to confirm also in the general report that when we look at the total quantum of irregular expenditure, we've also taken steps to say what percentage of this total did we specifically trace in respect of the receipt of goods and services in the audit. And we've come to a figure of about 86% of that. We've actually specifically satisfied ourselves in the audit that goods and services were received in respect of them. What is not clear is whether the payment that was made was not too much than what ought to have been paid because of all the issues of lack of transparency with supply chain management and so on. It is that uncertainty when we highlight it in the irregular expenditure that we say those that are charged with oversight need to take specific interest in that particular category of transactions in irregular expenditure so that all of them, including the oversight, can be satisfied that much as we are happy that you've got the goods that you were buying, but is it really worth this much that we spend X amount and this is what we've already received in respect of it? And I think it's those type of issues that irregular expenditure is highlighting. And if I go straight to it in terms of what we really are talking about in terms of this irregular expenditure, you'll see, in fact, I think I said 86, but it's 89 on page 20 on the second bullet. We're saying here that such expenditure, this irregular expenditure, does not necessarily mean that the money had been wasted or that fraud had been committed. We're bringing the attention of these amounts to the oversight so that oversight can help determine this, because irregular expenditure, according to the PFMA, must be investigated in order to arrive at a decision as to whether somebody needs to pay something if there's a liability or it is condoned, because that particular practice which was pursued, which was not in line with supply chain management rules, is understood in the context of what it is that was being bought. In the absence of that, the audit highlights it, and until such time that that particular investigation happens, it will continue to be irregular expenditure, and all transactions arising from that contract in subsequent years will attract irregular expenditure because of the initial deviation from supply chain. So we're saying, therefore, that 89% was received of that 42.5 billion of irregular expenditure relating to supply chain prescripts. And clearly, Chair, we're saying again on the third bullet that this type of non-compliance in the process needs to be investigated so that there can be reasons given to it, and oversight can then subject it to their own independent scrutiny to determine, among others, whether the occurrence of this irregular expenditure was it as a result of an unintended error. That will probably be an administrative oversight by somebody who is acting in a supply chain management process but do not have an appreciation of the rules that need to be undertaken. And that normally happens also when there is no independent review of the work that happens. So those will be the issues that will probably pop up to say, we can see this is possibly an unintended error for whatever the reason, but it will only be known once the investigation happens. If it is to do with negligence, somebody not deliberately not implementing a known control in terms of their line of duty, their responsibility, whether it is the surfacing or the approval of the transaction, or there may be those that, based on the outcome of the investigation, it will determine whether they are done with an intention to work against the requirements of controlling procurement. And typically those will be situations where there's ill intent. So when we raise this issue of irregular expenditure, we are raising a multitude of possibilities of outcomes that could arise as a result of this irregular expenditure. And I think we want to put it at that level so that we can trigger the next level of engagement, specifically around certain items of it. So that's the emphasis, Chair, I wanted to put on the area of irregular expenditure. And also identify the fact that if one looks at Section 38 of the PFMA, among other things, it calls on the accounting officers to prevent as well as to identify instances of irregular expenditure as they happen. So if you look at on page 21, what you are showing here on page 21, the blue, or rather the navy part of this, is irregular expenditure that was known to the accounting officers and was willingly disclosed by them in the financial statements. So I think it's almost saying that there is an appreciation of that requirement. The fact that they could not prevent it from happening in the first place is a different discussion. But I think from a transparent reporting point of view, what we are saying in the Navy is that these are items that were identified by the auditees themselves because they know that the PFMA requires disclosure to be made of it. However, I think the further question that arises is there any way that this can be prevented instead of relying on the fact that you are only going to detect it and report it after it has happened? Because then these are two different questions that need to be answered so that the other can cancel the other. And then, of course, the audit, through additional efforts of the audit, we also pick up a portion of it as well, which we report on as well. Strange enough, when we dealt with the finalization of these audits, our cutoff date was the 12th of August, as you can see, Chair, on page 21 of this slide. And because of those contestations, and I think it brings back some of the issues that we are talking about, you know, there were a lot of boxing engagements and people putting out fights and this and that and coming with legal arguments and legal opinions on various issues. But ultimately, when everything was done subsequently, we ended up, if you look at the including audits subsequently finalized after 12 August, we ended up with a significant ramping up of that overall irregular expenditure, which was prior to concluding on these contestations was sitting at 31.5 billion. And lo and behold, another 14 point something billion pops in after the 12th August clearance of those issues. And the biggest portion of it is a PRASA-related irregular expenditure. I'm sure you look at page 22, and you'll see that at that date, up to the 12th of August, PRASA was not included in the final analysis of the total irregular expenditure. However, they brought their own big bath in respect of the quantum of the irregular expenditure. So I think the important issue around this one, Chair, is really to send the message that this is exactly one of those things. I guess the issue of irregular expenditure also attracts interesting conversations because it's not a design of the audit that there is a reporting of the irregular expenditure. It's a requirement of the PFMA that instances of irregular expenditure must be reported, and the PFMA says so. And so when we write it in our report, we say it exactly as the PFMA wants it to be said. So it's not our term, because some people think that we have designed a term called irregular expenditure that sends, sometimes sends people's chemical imbalance in a way, you know, and make them feel threatened that we say they are involved in something funny. But I think the reality is that we use the time in the audit to try and get to the bottom of what are the possible things that could have contributed to it. And I think that's why we say this is a matter that oversight needs to go to the bottom of, so that once they know the answer, they then can say, of this total, we are happy that after the investigation, X amount is condoned, X amount is still to be followed up, and further investigations of other amounts needs to happen. So that's really the key message for us, Chair. But this is the area where the potential for that to happen. Perhaps while I'm on this one, I'll probably take you to page 52. I'll play back and forth, Chair, but I'll remember to not skip the important issues. Let me take you straight to page 52, Chair, while I speak about this irregular expenditure. What I think is important to note in terms of this slide, Chair, you'll see that it's got no heading and it's got no narrative in it. It's basically a formula here, which is a formula attributable to some research that was done by a professor on issues that attract corrupt activity in various institutions. And the C in terms of this represents the word corruption, if you may summarize it easily. And M in terms of a formula is environments where there is a domination of monopoly supply. So that's what M is. It's basically the domination of monopoly supply of goods and services, of labor services in the form of providing employment, in the form of providing business opportunities and all of that. By this I mean, if somebody has qualified in a training college as a teacher, the only place they can go and find a teaching post is in a department of education in the district where they want to teach. There's no other place that offers teaching posts other than the official Department of Education as such. So that's what we are referring to here as an example. And if you look at the D is the level of discretion, if you like. Discretion, because the D is in respect of the people who are assigned the responsibility to implement various programs, whether it is employing teachers, as I say, whether it is employing nurses, whether it is buying goods and materials for the construction of a hospital or for the construction of a school or a road, any one of those things that are goods and services provided by government in a monopolistic kind of fashion. Because the roads that we drive on are not built by a private company out of their own account, nor are the schools and hospitals that we go to. So that's the context. So the people here, the D, is the extent of the discretion applied in the implementation of the programs and so on. And the A is represents accountability. So what we are saying here, and that's why I want to bring the context back to the page 23, we are saying in an environment where you've got this kind of supply, take an example with this. If this teacher who's looking for a teacher's post gets told that you must pay me 5,000 rands if I can provide you a teacher's post, it means that me that's insisting on the 5,000 is extending the extent of discretion that I've been allowed in implementing the rules for engagement of teachers. That's what it means. And therefore, if there's no accountability over this person who exercises this D, and they are in an environment where this teacher has got nowhere else to run to except this district officer because of the monopoly, it creates an environment where there's a fertile opportunity for corrupt activity to happen. And that's the point that we're highlighting in this area of irregular expenditure, is that even before you investigate it, it has got all the characteristics and elements that could contribute to deviations from what the money was supposed to be spent on. The reason being that there is no A that is effective over the D and the application of the rules by the people who are implementing programs. Hence, we've got this growing number of irregular expenditure. It is on the back of breaking the rules beyond what is allowed for in terms of supply chain. So that's the area of irregular expenditure. And of course, wasteful expenditure, Chair, just to cover it briefly, it's still in the on the high side if you want to compare it from last year. But these are areas where money is really spent in vain in certain instances. It's either the litigation and claims that result in this or the penalties that kick in when certain provisions of contracts that departments have entered into are not adhered to. And I think in an environment where I have to pay, say, the VAT account by the 25th of the month, and the administrative processes within that department do not ensure that we enforce that particular discipline, when we pay that amount on the 29th of the month, there will be penalties and interest that is charged. And those are the type of issues that we are highlighting here. To say that, why do we have this thing growing up? Because obviously that money was never meant for those kind of things. It is money spent in vain. There's no value that has been received on the back of that particular expenditure. And it's starting to start growing up a little bit again. In the area of unauthorized expenditure, Chair, clearly I think we're starting to see a decline going in the right direction. And perhaps an important point to note with this one is that, as we have all heard in the budgets last week, there's no more to put into the system if it has not been authorized. So there's areas where the original budget is exceeded, but there are also other areas which are non-cash in nature in terms of this. If there's a need for the adjustment of certain values of assets because of the application of an accounting standard, they probably would not have foreseen the item for purposes of their budget, and if they put in an entry against that item where there's no budget, it will be shown as unauthorized. But I think the overall issue about this is to focus the energy of oversight on those instances where budgets allocated are exceeded, rather than once-off things that are not recurring. Page 29, the issue of consequence management. There's a couple of cases that we've looked at, Chair, which are an indication of the consequences that we've been talking about over time. There's obviously some starting to emerge, some cases that are being investigated, and of course one of the points that we have noted over time is that many of these tend to take quite a long period of time, and we never see the finality of some of them after they had been started. And we were encouraged, Chair, as we were profiling these outcomes here by the engagement you had the other week with the anti-corruption task team, and we thought that based on those conversations as well as what we are picking up here in terms of the investigations that have been reported around SCM findings, there could be some additional insights that you could pick up in the report to do some comparisons and to do some assessment of where the progress is. The area on page 30 slide, again, I spoke at length earlier about the slow response by management on the issues that need to be addressed in the audits. That trend is not getting any better compared to the previous periods, as well as the issue of consequences. A slow declining number, but still on the high side in terms of where there were specific commitments made to deal with consequences. As far as the way forward is concerned on the PFMA outcomes, I think it's important to highlight the need for the basic controls to be prioritized, Chair, in ensuring that every year we deal proactively with audit issues. We are aware that the committee, SCOPA, has already undertaken that task, and would like you to ensure that you use the general report to get more and more additional insights, because there's a lot of analytical work that we've also done to support the effort of oversight, so that as you look at these slides are just a highlight of what you will see in the general report when it is tabled, but at least it will assist you in having an appreciation for the reports that you are busy with now in terms of what are the key issues that you need to focus on as you drive your oversight work. We've also seen another feature which came out in these audit outcomes, Chair, which is a troubling development, we must say, as far as the audits are concerned. The emergence of what is called implementing agents in some provinces. You know, we've got a budget, we're not going to do this ourselves, we're going to ship it out to an external party to help us implement a particular project, either in health or in whatever area. And some of these have been troubling from an SCM point of view, because those outside parties will conduct their business on behalf of this government entity in the way they see best, because they are not necessarily subjected to the same rules of scrutiny that the entity or department would be subjected to. So if you look at issues of substance versus form, of that transaction. The form of the transaction looks like a good transaction, but when you start looking at the underlying substance in terms of this implementing agent and the additional costs that come with that, because remember, when you do that, you now are opening the gates for quite a number of layers of people who are going to do all manner of things that are going to become a bill ultimately. Whereas in the budgeting stage, in terms of this, some of these things were never thought of, you know. So we're finding supply chain management deficiencies in this area in particular, especially that there's now a third party that starts getting involved in the implementation of these activities. It's been quite an issue that we focused on from an audit point of view, so that we can begin to interrogate it. We've got a lot of write-up in it, and it's emerging in quite a number of provinces as a trend in certain areas, but not all. I think it's limited in a few. We spoke about the pushback issues, Chair, and I think you've covered them. We'll share some insights on this, because I think it's an area that requires to be managed. We are managing it as best we can, but there are elements in it that require to be looked at overall by oversight, just to make sure that the pushbacks must become normal in an audit, but they must not become the strain in trying to complete audits. And after you've finalized matters, when legal issues have been cleared, you find that you are exactly where you were on the day that you were supposed to sign. And there's a number of these that have arisen in quite a number of provinces, Chair, but I think the Free State stood out with many of these departments, and many of them, in fact, have ultimately, at the end, ended up with a negative outcome anyway. So I think if you look at page 33, we've had some very open engagements with many of these, including at the overall provincial level, to ensure that we put matters on the table in terms of what we see emerging. There's also another trend which we have also noted, which has to do with some significant legal contestations. As it were, when an audit matter arises, I'll put lawyers to it, and then we'll have a legal argument that goes on and on and on and on, and then there's an opinion this and an opinion that. But when you look at all of this at the end of the day, the real issue that needed to be dealt with was just to restore the discipline. But the appetite to incur additional expenditures on these legal fees and all of that, because they come with senior counsel costs on matters that are to do with non-compliance, largely with supply chain. So we want to flag this matter so that as you scrutinize the legal expenditures in your financial statement scrutiny, we also start paying attention to these, particularly where their financial statements have been outstanding. There's one instance, in fact, in our case where we ended up incurring some significant cost ourselves because some of these things require to be defended, as it were. So I thought those were the highlights, Chair, as far as the PFMA is concerned and as far as the financial statements that you are starting to scrutinize through the table are concerned. And then, as I said, just to deal briefly with a few highlights in terms of the other reports that will be contained in the same general report. As I said earlier on, the one sector report that we've selected, and we've basically said in this period we're going to try and pay attention to quite a number of the portfolios so that we're not only focusing on the mechanical and control-related matters, important as they are, but we felt that those that exercise oversight will have the benefit of additional insights when they look at programs such as the education infrastructure delivery. You'll remember, Chair, we have been in this area before where we did a performance audit on the delivery of infrastructure in various provinces. I think it was 6 years or so ago. And we're continuing on that path because we said those recommendations that were captured in that performance audit report are now going to become incorporated in our annual statutory audits so that we remain seized with those internal control matters that required to be fixed in ensuring that there is proper delivery effectively and efficiently of education infrastructure. You'll see some further work that has been done in the past year in that area to assess whether there has been or there has not been improvement as far as the education infrastructure delivery is concerned. Also, the education districts, insofar as they are disciplines, because the districts are responsible for looking after their various units of education wherever they are, and among other things, they are seized with the responsibility to also manage finances, and we are reflecting on the extent to which we have found internal controls to be in place at those levels, because the reason many of the education departments, as you saw the audit outcomes, are the way they are is because an education department in a province relies on the rigor and the disciplines that were put in place by those that are running the district areas. In the absence of documents coming from there, the guys in the head office know no better. And that's why sometimes they accept these negative audit outcomes with pain, because the control over the real delivery of the staff into the schools in the network of basic education is not always in their control. So that's one area we've also examined, Chair, which you will find some interesting insights when you evaluate the education part of the portfolio. Teacher professional development, the learner teacher support materials. We've focused on the areas of procurement here where we assessed issues of procurement and the distribution of textbooks, some of the controls, the disciplines, issues from distribution to warehouse, from warehouse to where the learners are, and what sort of deficiencies in those controls that have been identified through the audit. And there are further other areas that we have examined. As we have seen in the portfolio that deals with skills development, when we looked at the portfolio split of the budget groups, the TVET colleges stood out as a particular area that has created this. And some of it has also got to do with the fact that they come from a history where they did not have these accountability requirements, but they continued doing the TVET work at the beginning. And I think some of the weaknesses we are seeing there are still at rudimentary stages, and I think we need to make sure we deal with them before they become a systemic challenge. But of course, there's also infrastructure that is being spent on in the TVET colleges and some of the areas that we focus on in the higher education and training part of the education center is the two areas of skills development in terms of what are the outcomes and the outputs based on strategic plans of the various sectors, because all of them contribute to that same portfolio, the one that had regression of audit outcomes. And some of the instruments that we are testing in terms of their outcomes and what they are contributing to. So, and then page 36 and 37, Chair, as you can see there, these are the areas that we have had findings in, and you'll probably have a better insight of it when we look at the detail in the general report. And then the audit outcomes for the education sector, if one looks at the 2015-2016, there's a combination here, Chair. At least the Western Cape, as far as education, was clean. The rest are qualified, and many of them are unqualified with findings. And a lot of these findings are also to do with reporting on their performance as well as issues pertaining to how their districts operate in relation to their expectation to report on their behalf. Going into the health sector, one as well, there will be a sector report also included with the general report when we launch it on the 16th. And the health sector report, Chair, will also be another area that we focus on because we also dealt with issues around planning and maintenance of infrastructure here, the information technology in that sector, the management of healthcare waste, as well as use and maintenance of medical equipment. And this is the area where we relied a lot on some of our professional teams within our performance audit unit who have got this kind of training. So if you look at these reports, it will be reports that were not driven by us as accountants, but we had to exercise an oversight over them. But there's a lot of good insights that come out of them. Sometimes when you walk into a ward, you've got no idea how a particular machine is supposed to be positioned or where it's supposed to be or whether it is in use or not. And it was very helpful, Chair. I think it is testimony to the growth that we have seen in the effort that we've tried to put into these performance audits. And I think the health sector will be one example when you look at the detail that it was not one of those things where accountants are looking for what did not work, but it was an exercise by those that understand the use of medical equipment and other things in terms of whether it is utilized for the purpose intended or is it something that was bought to try and get rid of the budget and then we let it lie there. And when you arrive at that hospital, this machine arrived 12 months ago, but it has never been switched on. These are the type of issues that we are looking at to say it's all good when you put in the debit in the financial statements, but nobody knows whether that machine is put in use because it can happen. It can happen that in chasing to spend the budget that you didn't plan for, you sumar went for whatever was available in the market. But now when supply chain processes do not work properly, it may happen that you may, for whatever reason, had a reason to spend that money even though there were no preparations for having that machine operational. So these are the kind of issues that this report will shed some light on. Right, let's take off from that. I'll now deal with another performance. This one is a performance audit report, which is in the process of being finalized. Finalized the final review, but we are hoping that by the end of... this is now a separate report, Chair, other than those ones. They are attached to the general report, the ones I've mentioned. This one on page 42 onwards is a standalone report where we examined the question that is on the page. How effective is the basic water infrastructure program implemented on behalf of the department? As we know, the Department of Water and Sanitation will use quite a number of entities that are in the area of hydro engineering and all of that to realize their objectives. And what we interrogated here in looking at the value chain of the supply of water, starting from the sources, which are your dams and your rivers, right through to your water treatment plants, to your reservoirs, from there to the reticulation system that links to operating with the municipality to ensure that the water comes out of the dam. That's the kind of exercise that we looked at, to say what are the inefficiencies, the deficiencies that we have observed in some of these disciplines, in some of the contracts that are being managed, the challenges that are being experienced with regards to issues of extensions, with issues of lack of proper planning, which results in contracts having to extend for far too long, attracting huge costs if there's no proper supervision over them. These are the type of issues that we are highlighting in this water and sanitation infrastructure development, Chair. Because the reality is that the statutory audit will not have a deeper line of sight into the mechanics of what this thing does in the background. Even though it may trigger a good audit outcome, but the reality you might be in sitting with huge amounts of potential savings that are being wasted because of extensions that result in the actual delivery not happening as planned. And these are some of the issues that we thought oversight will probably be interested in. If you just look at some of the deficiencies that we are looking at, it's the likes of lack of integrated planning. And that integrated planning, if you unpack it, it's things like when in the value chain, you discover that the municipality was never aware that they were supposed to make available a budget for them to connect the reservoir to the taps. But the reality is that because of this integrated nature of this delivery, other people in the value chain have delivered their bid and the budget has been spent. But the communities for whom this budget has been spent do not have water still. Not because that money was spent and no real tangible value was received. It's just that in the process of the integrated planning, the municipality was not put in the picture that they've got a budget that they need to make available in order to implement the last bit of the project, as in laying the pipes for the reticulation from the reservoirs to the taps, that type of example. So these are some of the issues that this audit has surfaced, to say that it's good, all good enough when you end up with a clean audit, but it could have been better if you fix the last bit and everybody will be happy because there'll be water then at the end. Management of pharmaceuticals. In fact, that particular one on the water and sanitation, we covered 6 of the 9 provinces. And I think there was a reason for it, because if one looks at it, it comes from the infrastructure grants that were made available for dealing with some of the backlogs in water supply and all of that. And I think it was on the background of that we picked up that audit as well, because there were huge grants both in terms of the infrastructure, the MIGs and all of that, that went towards funding the alleviation of water backlog over time. And I think there are a lot of interesting insights in there to show how the curve has shifted from 1994 to 2015 as a start in terms of the analysis of the backlog as it is now. Management of pharmaceuticals is largely a issue as well, Chair, that focuses on do these medicines get to the ultimate beneficiaries in some of these places. We found a number of instances also in certain areas where if you look at issues of storage, you'll see that there are pictures that we share in the performance audit report, where we look at how the systems are observed, the accountability for the different medicines as they come from order to storage to distribution to final dispense from the dispensary. And we look at issues as well in terms of where are these medicines stored. In certain places, you'll find that there's a central storage facility in a particular province, which is a central supplier base for all the hospitals or public facilities that require medicines and pharmaceuticals. But when you look at the conditions under which they are stored, some of them you can already see that they are in a condition where they cannot be used again. So these are some of the issues from a wastage point of view that are detected through this performance audit, to say that there's a lot of inefficiencies in also handling the type of stuff that has got expiry dates and all that. All of these audits that we're going to be presenting, we've already interacted with the primary stakeholders in the form of the executive authorities, in the form of the oversight structures there, so that certain steps can be taken. And I think many of them have embraced the outcomes that have come out of this, because it gives them additional tools to focus their efforts. As far as our planned activities for for next year, in terms of the transversal audits, we've taken a view to develop delivery capability over the next 5 years in these focus areas that are on page 45. As we have been doing already with health, we are still on course in terms of that, because we've identified early on that is one of the key spending priorities. The education one, we are also continuously focusing on this area by picking up different elements of the delivery chain within education, whether it is learner support materials, whether it is education teacher support or infrastructure. The other area that we're going to be starting to give more focus on is focus area number three, to start focusing on the local government housing and community services. So this is a plan over the next 5 years that we are projecting as the key focus areas, Chair. So we'll share with you, of course, the state-owned companies are also in the queue to start developing specific performance audit focus points that we need to drive to elevate some of the issues that can complement the oversight that comes with the financial statement audits. So those are the audits, those two reports, Chair, that we... There's another one we've done, but it's merely a provincial one. I think it's a Gauteng-based audit. It's an audit, a performance audit on the urban renewal infrastructure. There were a number of areas that were identified in that province where urban renewal infrastructure in the West Rand and in other parts of the Gauteng province where significant funds were put in to do various things in places like Alex in the West Rand and other areas. And that specific performance audit has also been done, but it will be tabled, obviously, in the province once the tabling time for it comes. But all of those will find their way into the table by hopefully the end of November. On page 46 to page 48, those three pages, I'll just deal with them at a high level quickly. The area of the Section 4.3 audits, Chair, we just wanted to give some high-level feedback, and I think we'll be working closely with this matter. This is the area where Section 4.3 of the Public Audit Act allows us to opt out in certain situations if historically that particular audit was done by outside auditors, and sometimes we make the choice because over time we didn't have the capacity to do it ourselves. So here we are just highlighting some of the things that we are doing now, even though that work is being done by external auditors. One of the things is to enhance the interactions we are having with them to make them aware upfront of how to apply our audit methodology. We also send our people to engage with the statutory auditors at planning stages of these audits, as well as the audit steering meetings when the audits are being done, to reinforce the risk assessment process for all of these audits, so that when they report to the boards of these entities, at least we have covered the basic issues. So there's a lot of work that is happening here, Chair, and I think some of these audits, we've also been getting the nod to do this work from within the audit office. Some of these things are still in the pipeline, and some of them we have already taken back a few of them. Currently, we do the audit of the South African Post Office fully from within the office. We do the likes of Petro SA from internally, SA Express, the Airports Company of South Africa, Safcol, and quite a number of others that are operating in the broader space outside of the realm of the departments. So there's a mixed bag here. We keep an eye focused on this, and we certainly take back those that we are approached by the respective executive authorities and accounting authorities to audit ourselves. I have not seen the final correspondence, but we did get similar correspondence with regards to the audit of SAA, but we will wait for final confirmation once they have processed their staff internally. So there's a huge focus on giving us, and I think the capacity from us, Chair, to do this work is no doubt in place if we look at the numbers of people we have and the kind of opportunity that it may bring to continue on the path that we have established with regards to departments, municipalities, and provinces. The one bit of sharing that I just want to do, Chair, and then I'll finish off in the next 5 minutes, is what is on page 49 to page 51. Chair, as I said in the beginning, the primary responsibility for the maintenance of accounting records, as well as the accountability for reporting on the activities of each of the departments and entities, lies largely as defined in the PFMA in Section 38, which calls for the development of risk management processes as well as instruments and mechanisms to prevent all manner of undesirable outcomes. That responsibility lies largely with the accounting officer, and I think there are very clear expectations as set out in Section 38. One of the things that we have examined over the last, say, 5 to 10 years, has been the absence of visible evidence that those expectations, among other things, are being brought to action. And I think when we start looking at the attributable reasons for these negative audit outcomes, they are largely pointing to the role of leadership insofar as the financial management and performance instruments are concerned. All of them under the direct control and supervision of an accounting officer, because that's the accounting officer who employs those people who must see to it that these things are in place. So having recognized that to be the reality, and the fact that if one looks at the instrument of internal oversight within departments, which is largely the internal audit, many of them range from non-existent to not effective in doing what they are supposed to do. And ideally, what we are proposing here, which is an enhanced version of what we have been doing anyway over time, is this key control engagement, which is about a status of records review. Let me just give an example of a scenario that we are dealing with. If a department that has a March year end, like we have in our system, the new year, the first quarter ends in June, and the second quarter ends in September. What we are saying here in terms of the status of records review is that we can do an independent review of the transactions as they are captured in the trial balance of that department up to the end of the second quarter. Look at this trial balance, analyze it, and engage, seek an engagement after the end of that second quarter with the accounting officer, the CFO, and the head of supply chain to appraise them of the issues that are likely to derail their progress, firstly, towards the preparation of financial statements as a red flag. And to say that if we look at all your control account reconciliations up to the second quarter, because the expectation is that you've got to have somebody in finance who is a CFO whose job is to independently review the reconciliations and prepare the reconciliations, so that if there's a payment that has gone in the bank account, let's say for 64,000, for argument's sake, somebody must specifically reconcile the accounting record to the bank account to establish whose 64,000 payment is this. That's what control is about. And that's why at the end of the audit, everybody runs around and start fighting because they don't know what was happening throughout the year because they did not do the necessary supervision of accounting records during the end of every quarter and every month as it is expected. Because you find in most of these places, the finance department has got very little vacancy. It's got a CFO, it's got all the other managers and other people, but the work that's supposed to be done by them is not being done. And I think this effort is to say, at the end of the second quarter, we see that all the control account reconciliations have not been done. It's a high risk of audit failure, and we are wanting to report this so that you can be aware that come the time of the audit, when I go back to the issue of the pushback and the outstanding audits, there are no surprises. And through this effort, we will also say, last year, when we finalized the audit, we issued a management letter highlighting all the audit weaknesses that have been identified with regards to last year's audit. Have you made any progress with regards to those matters? Have you addressed them? What is the evidence that you have done anything about them since the last audit? This is an appraisal engagement, Chair, to try and bring forth the issues that are important in the audit. It's not an audit exercise in itself, but it will result in an escalation. If there's an accumulation of these issues over time, we will escalate it. So that once we've identified the matters which will cause audit failure or will cause huge risks in the audit, we can at least have the first opportunity to highlight them, so that by the time the audit comes, we're not dealing with surprises here. We're dealing with issues that are known in terms of what are the categories of possible audit failure based on our assessment of how your financial disciplines are being supervised and scrutinized. Then on page 50, we just highlighting normally the key areas that this intervention will focus on. We look at the role that oversight and monitoring plays in the in-year monitoring process, and I think that it will cover the likes of portfolio committees as well, because they are the ones who also do the in-year monitoring as expected. We'll just assess as to how they have kept a watch over the things that are on their plate with regards to supervising the implementation of matters of internal control weaknesses. We look at the financial management area, as I've used an example of the accounting reconciliations, the accumulation of performance management information, issues of procurement and contract management. Here, one of the things, we're not doing a detailed audit, but certainly if we are aware, based on your budget, that you are going to have a commitment of huge expenditures, for example, towards a capital project, which is significant enough to attract a lot of risks, we just want to make inquiries as to whether, in the procurement process, have you ensured that there is compliance with supply chain? Have you put in place a proper contract management to ensure that there are no possible risks and abuses of the contracts? All of those things will be the key areas that we examine. And what will come out of it will be no more than a 3 or 4 pager of highlights of red flags that need to be watched prior to the end of the audit. And that's why we call this a status of accounting records review. Because over the time, we've often been picking up the question, and we've been doing this but more on a lower scale when we did the robots dashboard. But here we are saying, while we are producing that robot even now, let's try and go a little bit deeper so that we can begin to have an appreciation ourselves of what is the status of accounting records in a particular environment? Because that is normally, once that is in place, once that is rigorously supervised and controlled, it normally triggers the type of audit outcomes that are desirable in the environment. So, Chair, we are starting out on a pilot on this, which we are hoping to finish by the end of this month. We have selected 2 sites per business units being our provinces as well as those national business units. So in a province, we'll pick up a municipality and a department and do the pilot of this data of records up to the time indicated here. And we will start on a phased implementation of this and the rollout of this across our audit portfolios come the first quarter of 2017. It's a research that we've done in the background when we looked at all the audit reports over the years and started asking ourselves, where can we additionally put in place what is needed? But ultimately, once the system, and we've communicated this when we were interacting with all the provinces and national leaderships on the audit outcomes, and once all of this has been captured and has assumed some level of a rigorous process and rollout, we think that ultimately this is what an internal audit function ought to do in a department. But in an environment where the internal audit is not strong enough, I think we need to start nurturing this thing towards handing it over ultimately to an internal audit, because there's no use for us as external auditors to be getting involved in that area, but we can get involved as far as the review process is concerned. But ultimately, if you think about an internal audit, it's supposed to be supervising these instruments, these different parts within the department. If there's a huge payroll department, internal audit needs to be doing tests regularly in the processes within payroll. If there's a strong internal audit function, it's supposed to be doing tests in the financial management environment, so that if there's a 64,000 payment in a particular bank account, it doesn't lie there as a reconciling item, when in fact it could have been somebody who had inappropriate access into the information systems and were able to go into a supplier on the database and change that bank account into their own bank account, and the payment flows through without any transaction that had been created in the supplier side. These are all possibilities that could happen if that internal control is not put in place and is not regularly supervised. And that's where we looking at this thing from, Chair. And Chair, I think on that we shall leave it at this, but all, let me just, before I do that, finish off with the last page on page 54. And this is to do with our audit methodology And of course, this is an ongoing enhancement, Chair, as we look at the methodology that we use to strengthen the instrument of the audit. I think one of the things that we have already achieved through the performance audits has been to bring back the insights from the performance audits into the regularity audit through an integrated process. And we've done an elaborate amount of research to look at how to continuously improve the audit effort. And I'm sure if you, as members of Oversight, have any additional inputs to share with us, we would welcome them. But we now think the amount of time that we spent and the research that we looked into, as well as discussions we've had with our colleagues on this, is also starting to give us more focused and integrated, robust risk approach. I think, as you see in some of the slides that we have shared, where we are looking at different elements of this major information highway and say, how can we pull it all together in one place so that Oversight has got more than one view of the problem? Because sometimes when we look at all these matters from a pure financial audit point of view, it does introduce some challenges. But I think if we've got additional other information from a performance audit or integrated insights, it helps in promoting good governance. And we hope that, Chair, you'll find what we will be presenting in the PFMA in the next 2 weeks to assisting you towards achieving that objective. And the performance audits certainly are a growing phase in the work that we are doing, and we think that we will be doing a lot more of these so that there's no sight lost of what is happening in the effectiveness, efficiency, and economy with which the goods and services are procured. Thanks very much, Chair. I return to you.
Thank you very much, Auditor General. Well, I'm not going to add anything at this stage, but hand it over to the comrades if there is any, and request that if we have questions, it's possible to have 15 questions, but let's just restrict them to two or three so that other comrades can also have the opportunity. Comrade Vincent, Ross, Comrade Chilwane, let's take the three.
No, Chair, I don't have any questions. I wanted to make two or three principal, what would you call it, input, Chair, to, because I think it was first of all, thank you very much, AG, for what you've given us, Chair. And my input is really based on the realization that I think where we stand currently, there really is a need for a total and unrelentless onslaught on corruption. So I'm doing it in that capacity and what you've done. And let me start with the last point that you've made, AG. And it's also covered, I think, in your slide 17. I am not sure, Chair, that the current practice of the AG of going in, identifying material misstatements, the AG identifying material misstatements, and then affording the department to correct them and give that department an unqualified audit report. I'm not sure that is helping us. And I'm also not sure, AG, about the thin line between being a consultant and an auditor. So if you go in, assist the department to get an unqualified audit, and then be the external auditor, I'm just asking the question, are we not traversing that thin line of consultant and auditor? And it's the same thing as your last statement, because you correctly identified that's really the role of internal audit that you're doing. So I'm just asking that principal question. And I don't think you're assisting us, because many of the audits are unqualified, yet it's unqualified because of your intervention. The second point that I want to make, AG, is, and again, it's a principal one, and it should be open for discussion. On your slide 33, you spoke about the concern of implementing agents. and the fact that they then argue that once we've transferred the money to implementing agents, it's no longer subjected to AG's rigor. Chair, you would know that we have argued that we don't think that outsourcing accountability is something that works. Because we've given money to the department or to the province. The province then goes and gives that money to an implementing agent and then argues that, well, AG, you can't touch it. I think that is outsourcing accountability, and I think that we should have a discussion on that. I really don't think that that's the route we should be going. And in that sense, Chair, maybe if the AG gave us the details, we could follow it up at a political level, because I don't think it's a correct practice. We certainly can't outsource accountability. The last one, Chair, that maybe I want to raise is on slide 37. I think I tried to mark it, but on slide 37, AG, somewhere you say, slide 37, or 31 maybe, sorry. If I could just get there. Yeah, on slide 31, Chair, and again I'm raising it as a point of debate. We recommend that the auditees respond with urgency to our recommendations in improving whatever the case might be. AG, I'm putting the question. The Auditor General is a Chapter 9 institution, Chairperson. Now, you are putting recommendations that very clearly you're raising it because you have a sense that they don't always take these things seriously. Has the time not come for us to ask the question, what real powers does the AG have? If you're a Chapter 9 institution, what real powers do you have? Is it just to recommend? Because I'm using that as taking the other Chapter 9 institutions as an example, because, and I'm not making a decision one way or the other, Chair. I'm saying let's open the discussion. Yours are recommendations, we recommend, everybody recommends, and we're talking here onslaught on corruption. And I'm using it in that context, and I'm just asking the question, should we not be further scrutinizing exactly how far you can go and push the envelope in the fight against corruption? I'm talking about it specifically in the fight against corruption, Chair. Why does the Auditor General recommend and others have more than just recommending powers? Or should we leave it at recommendation? That's just the question that I wanted to ask, Chairperson. And like I said, these are just comments that I think will assist us as we go ahead in terms of strengthening oversight. And your big cry and our big cry of the lack of consequent management. Really, that's the problem. You identify something as the audit, as the accounting officer, as irregular. All you do is, Chair, listen to what happens. They identify it. Then they go and record it. And according to the rules of accounting, the AG says, well, if he's identified that this thing was done wrongly and he records it, I should be satisfied as the Auditor General and not qualify the report. And I'm saying this is where this thing comes in of departments. They could manipulate it. They could manipulate it because after he's recorded it, the AG then says it's unqualified. I think, Chair, that where you get irregular for 9 billion, for instance, surely it can't come back as an unqualified audit report. But it's unqualified because he identified it before the AG identified it. I can't understand how we have unqualified audit reports and we have irregular and wasteful expenditure for so much money. So those are the points that I'm saying, Chair. I don't know in which domain it belongs, but I just think it needs to be discussed so that we strengthen consequence management. Chair, thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, AG, for an excellent presentation. AG, just with regards to the audit outcomes and how you categorized and you gave us an impression of a slight regression from 2014-15. I'd just like to make sure that I agree with you on the slight regression and whether it should not be tabled as a serious regression in terms of a couple of factors. And the first one is with regards to the departments. We've seen that the departments unqualified with findings has actually got stuck on 53%. And we know the serious findings in terms of, let me take an example of the Department of Transport with those huge numbers, with a huge budget of 51 billion. And PRASA specifically, but that is now with the entities. But nevertheless, I was concerned that a slight regression is a bit light in terms of how you categorize your or your how you indicated your assessment in terms of the outcomes. And also just to note that we have now for the first time compared to 2015. Also 2% of non-tabling, and on the non-tabling it was quite serious. But exactly then also with regards to public entities that we've now seen 44 in adverse or non-submitted, 44 of these entities, either in an adverse category or in non-submitting, and I think that is a serious indictment on public entities, and I would categorize that perhaps as a serious regression. And then just linking this to irregular expenditures, we've seen that we were quite pleased when we compared the 2014-15 to 13-14, the regression of about 10 billion in irregular expenditure, but we've now seen a complete regression up again in irregular expenditure to, if I'm correct, 31 billion. I'd just like your assessment in terms of whether that should put us in a serious regression situation in terms of an overall assessment. And then just perhaps also thank you very much for dealing with the independent auditors. I think you've dealt with that and my questions are answered in that regard. But also in terms of recommendations, how do we enforce compliance? And just to add to my colleague perhaps, seeing that we really address the issue of corruption. I think, you know, that we should move more strictly towards alleged corruption must be criminally investigated. I know we have very good legislations, and specifically, I think it's Chapter 10 of the Public Finance Management Act in terms of consequences for the accounting officer. And then we have the public protector's findings that are now binding. And then we have the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, which we can use. But mostly, I think our domain is in the Public Finance Management Act and the verification of SARS compliance. But I'd like to add my concern with the input of the Honourable Smith that indicated the intervention by the Auditor General that I believe could be more specific and help us to enforce compliance in this regard, especially with regards to misconduct by the accounting officer. And then thank you for your suggestion of a review on the second quarter. I think that's very helpful. But certainly most of these non-compliance are deliberate non-compliance, and it's in the supply chain management. And I'd like also to have your views whether the procurement office is helping us in this regard and whether we can expect perhaps in the next term to see that we have any proof audit outcomes also in terms of irregular expenditure being addressed. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I think I've been partly covered by what other members have asked. And thank you, AG, for the briefing. I just wanted to add on the leadership, especially on slide 16, on the key observations that were made on the issue of the pushbacks, which some other departments or entities, they are threatening with legal actions for them not to be able to agree what is it that the auditors are saying. When you link it with the, I just forgot the slide, you link it with the Department of Home Affairs, I think, and Environment, where there's a disagreement in terms of the audit, which probably is something that has led for these departments that were having one of them yesterday, which have not submitted their annual, they've not tabled their annual report to Parliament. You would also would want to link it as well, AJ, you spoke about it, that most of the public entities will tend to come to use the private, private auditors. And it's a trend that will, it's a scary one, because if we've got an AG who's a government Chapter 9 institution, but some other people will tend to use this private auditors. What is the purpose of it? Is it the purpose that there are those pushbacks, or is the purpose that the office of the AG cannot handle the volume of the work? Maybe if we can get, you spoke about it, AG, partly, but one would have an interest in just finding out what is the agreement that you are having as you are having these meetings, in terms of them guiding, in terms of them, what is it that they are supposed to audit. The second issue, Chair, that I wanted to raise is on issue of supply chain management. There's somewhere where I talk about 2.5 billion that could not be. I can't get the slide. I'm looking. 2.5 billion on the issue of supply chain management, where awards have been awarded, but there's no proof. It seems that AG on that area, probably we are regressing, because if you've got awards that amount to a total of 2.5 billion. There's no proof. We could not audit because there's no information. Then it means that money is getting lost, and there's no one who wants to take that responsibility to say where does the money, because it's a lot of money. If we just say we have paid the amount that total about 2.5 billion and we're not proving, and then I don't know what do we need to do. Like Honorable Vincent has said, that maybe we need to open up a discussion, because in terms of the supply chain, you also go to the issue of those payment within 30 days. There are litigations because people are not being paid in time, and it also adds up to the amount. So I just wanted to raise those issues. Okay. Chairperson, thank you.
Comrade Board. Then we can have the response from the AG.
Good morning, Auditor General. I think you did a very good presentation, but I must express the sentiments and work on what Honorable Vincent Smith is raising. You see, when we started this term in 2015, you were robust. You were very clear what to expect and what we should do as SCOPA. You even condemned SCOPA or the public accounts committees by not giving you support, you see. For me, that brought up the bar, you see. Now, I'm like, the tone here is totally different in this report. You see, when basic education uses or go for 4 billion of whatever, you see, and you don't tell us where is the weakness or what are the issues. We as COPPA have been very clear that wherever we do presentation or where we talk, we always say that we are the center of our information, and we use you to be able to test our fight against corruption. And at this moment, you see, even the model that you are sadly drawing for us doesn't talk to the realities on the ground. In SCOPA, the argument is simple. It's a 20 cent that you have taken from the, not from you as the person, but from the ordinary people who are contributing revenue to be able to pay for their and maintain the state. Now you are taking a different tone, you see. And that is very surprising, you see. And from an informed position, when we took this route where the chairperson says to you that we then started saying what we hear is there's non-cooperation by officials. Non-cooperation by officials to make you to be able to do your work. And that resistance, I can tell you now where I'm seated, we've been feeling it ourselves that as members of SCOPA, in our determination to fight corruption, you deal with the hawks, you deal with anybody, the concern is there that the robustness that we have introduced into the system of how we deal with the fight against corruption, we might have good friends, but we're going to lose good friends. That's an attitude that you assisted us to adopt. But now here, it seems as if there's an issue. Take us through. Is there anything that makes you to have fears in your responsibilities or your ordinary people, staff? Is there something that is challenging them? No, don't worry. So you're not representing me, I'm representing myself. I've got information, I can give you more about your department. So please, don't start waving your head, you're going to create problems with me. So I'm just saying, our concern is that, is it correct? Look, it goes up to the executive, I can tell you. It's not something that I fear, you see, because this responsibility by the team that sits here, it's a responsibility of decided that you are going to go ahead on the basis of the information that you are providing. Do you think that your officials are faced with problems and Parliament is not doing the necessary protection or being able to come to you and assist you with the robustness that you have provided for us to be able to so that we can engage departments? Vincent is correct, Honorable Vincent, that the bottom line there is corruption. You see? And you can't fear it. I mean, you should never fear it. You must tell us that this is what exactly happens. As South Africans, as you could see them, they reject corruption. And they'll reject anyone who goes or practices of corruption. Why would you fear as the Auditor General? Take us through, because your report is very mimic. I mean, it doesn't talk. I don't say be robust, play to the platform. But in what we had come to realize, if you deal with your unauthorized, if you deal with your irregular expenditure, I mean, we deal with water and sanitation. We're talking about a figure of around 2 billion in a department that was established in 2 years' time, you see. What does that imply? Is that good progress, or are you going to say to us, no, there's small, little, no understanding of what happens, you see, and you are willing to go out of your way, go to provinces and fix the leaking that is taking place in taps? Is that what they are doing to us? Or is it what we are trying to do? That is the question we are asking ourselves. That, you see, even the way that I know that the chairperson was trying to be very mild. You see, to me, when you don't want to report back to the National Assembly and start reconciling with provinces and what, are you saying that the National Assembly is not performing in terms of your own responsibilities? Or are you running away from us on the basis that we have taken a robust decision that we are going to engage and be able to bring down the figures of corruption? But for us, that's the basic concern. And the information that they're providing is in front of us, you see. And we have always been saying that it is what we don't find, you see, in your solutions that they're providing. Is the lack of legislation that, as legislators, we're here to come and work with you. Are you saying there's no legislation, things are fine outside, things are running properly? You see, is that your attitude? Because I'll tell you now, I've been spending time to reconcile facts with what the environmental affairs and their lack of participation when they're invited by Parliament, you see. And at the end of the day, they're pointing fingers to how the Auditor General is not conducting, is not listening to them. I'm saying there's a lot of examples that are beginning to come our way where people are beginning to say, and they are resisting. Those that we have been seeing yesterday, even what we tried to help, South African Express, we're seeing them there yesterday. We have got information that comes from how institutions are beginning to behave in resisting to come and do their work and come and submit themselves to you. Do you think there's something wrong? Or do you think now you have without fear or favor in what the Constitution provides for you, is there a threat that we don't know about? Take us into confidence, Auditor General.
All right. Thanks very much. Do you still have capacity to take more inputs? I see Comrade Kekane and Comrade Kuno. But like I said, you know, you are here to empower us, and that's why most of it is inputs that seeks to clarify and enhance further. So let me give Comrade Kekane and Comrade Kuno, and then we can then go back and I don't see the sun because I'm here, so I can't tell what time it is. But it's fine. Okay, Comrade Kekane. Comrade Kekane.
No, thanks, Chair. Chair, let me also welcome the presentation. I think it is assisting us. But there's one area that I need advice on, because if you look at corruption or where we normally focus, that is ESCOPA and maybe the AG, we normally focus on big amounts and leave the people who are really that is corrupt. Because my understanding is, if you look at particularly the contract management, the supply chain management, that's where most of corrupt activities are happening, particularly on the issue of 500 and below, where officials would break that is contracts. As to how are we going to deal particularly with that issue, because if you look at you quantify the amount that is of corruption that is in that area, it is more than that is some of the issues that we are dealing with. They are breaking tenders, and you can see the sequence. For instance, that this tender was a 3 or 4 million tender. But unfortunately, what then they would do, they would submit it, that is for a 500, that is quotation, in this maybe term, and in another term, do the same thing. My biggest question is, how are we going to deal, that is, with that issue? The second issue that I'm impressed about in the presentation is the issue of the impact. Because it is well and good that is to deal with financial accountability. But in other areas, for instance, you look at provinces like Limpopo, and you look at the money that we spend as government in that area. Unfortunately, you would, at the end, see that there is some anomaly in that we spend a lot of money, but there's no improvement that is in the area. Now, I also want us to look at the issue of the impact of the money that we spend as government in these areas.
All right. Thank you, Comrade Comrade Kuno.
Thank you, Chairperson. And sorry about this morning. I had a problem with my dad. And thank you, AG, for the report. Chairperson, this report reflects on all of us as oversight committees who has to ensure accountability, and committees in Parliament in general, and the work of the AG. I think it's about time that we should make an impact out there. But the AGS was reporting there's a slight improvement, but there's no total improvement. And I think we lack something, you know, either as oversight committees or somewhere something is not done. And I think we need to get into the bottom of it and see how can we improve the outcomes, the audit outcomes, because it will be for the good of the country. But as you were presenting as well, I asked myself when you spoke about vacancy rate, that what can we do to solve it? Should we call the Public Service Commission and just check as the people who are overall looking at all departments and see how they can impact on departments, because it's a problem, you know, and you'll find that most of the departments have this problem year in, year out. So I think we should come up with solutions as well. And AG, like you said, people, different departments make commitments. They don't make them under duress. So it doesn't make sense when they cannot achieve what they've planned for. But again, like other years, we don't talk about underspending. And I think underspending is as wrong as overspending. Because when you underspend, it means the money that you have, you don't know what to do with it, or there's no service delivery. So I think we should also emphasize this underspending. And people need to know that it's not about, you know, having a clean audit only, but the main thing is giving a service to the people out there. And the last concern, Chairperson, the internal audit, the internal control. The AG emphasized this, especially towards the end of his presentation, that if there is no internal control, it means departments will have problems. So my question is, according to percentage-wise, do we have a lot of departments that do not have internal control and internal auditors? And maybe we should discuss that and see what can we do as COPPA to make sure that happens, because if it's a concern, I agree with you, we need to have internal control measures. If they are not there, we will have problems. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Do you have some leftovers?
No, AG, I just want you to deal with the state-owned institution, I mean like entities. And I was just going through our own report. You see, they're supposed to assist us with employment of our people, job creation. And if you don't go, is it that you don't have capacity to deal with them, or what is the challenge? I hear what you are saying.
Ross, come back. Continue.
Yeah? No, I hear what you are saying, AG, that you allow them to have internal audit, but the money that they have is massive, AG. It could assist us to be able to create employment. Where are we? I mean, because we want to be on top of them. We want to be on top of Transnet. We want to be on top of Brasa. But there's no sense from the Auditor General's report today that this priority is being taken. And these are some of the things that guide us within the National Development Plan. But where do you want to be? You see, politically. And I thought that as a country, when we adopted that vision, it does talk to Chapter 9 institutions also, that are you going along with us? Or is this really big? Look, you see, last time you told us about families doing business with institutions. This, to me, was pointing the correct direction. It has disappeared in your report. Why? I don't know. Is there fear? Or is there something else that we don't know as parliamentarians? Take us into confidence. AJ.
Okay. All right. I may as well say my 2 cents worth of observations, AG. I think the first one will be around SOEs. I'm sure I'm expressing a common sentiment that we would want your office audit more and more of the SOEs, especially the big and strategic ones. The ones around whom were from time to time forced to offer guarantees for them to use money that there is no proper auditing around it. SAA, I'm not sure if you're auditing SA Express, your big, big ones, your ESCOM, if ESCOM falls, the whole country collapses. I think it's very, very strategic to be left in the hands of private auditing firms who are merely doing business. I mean, you are auditing in the public interest, you know, and the whole range of them. I see, I can't remember the slide, but there's a slide where you're talking about the Section 4.3 audits. You set up the standards, but you see, AG, the problem is, and I see your language, you've couched it in a manner that suggests that at the end of the day they have a discretion because you encourage them to, you know, follow certain. Now, but I think for me the main concern is that whatever your engagements with them, when the annual reports come, their format and standard of reporting compared to how you report are just like day and night in terms of difference. And those annual reports, if anyone picks them up, they are not helpful to oversight. You can't use the audit reports of the private firms to do effective oversight compared to what the Auditor General does. And I think that's, for me, I think that is the greatest disservice that happens. I want to agree with Comrade Vincent on the misstatements. Let's talk to this thing. Because here's a department, it is a CFO, qualified. He works with the finances the whole year, compiles financial statements, and your office comes within a month. They're able to pick up that their mistakes. Within a month, they're able to pick up that there are mistakes in the either in the addition, in the calculations, and then you say to them, fine, here are these things, go and correct this. You know? I've always wondered whether how does that assist us? You know? And I think I raised this last year, Comrades, that maybe we need to look at just those reports where it is said there were material misstatements, and just have a hearing on that. How does it happen? How does it come? I mean, quality control. And if the AG gives them the second chance, how does it encourage them to be, you know, to be a little bit more serious on their work? So I'm just saying, some of these things that you do to assist departments, instead of them using that to move forward, they actually create complacency. I feel misstatements, unless they had hired me with my history, that's something. But somebody who says, I'm an accountant, I'm this and that, I've been CFO at such and such a place, and then the next thing, they just can't write, they just can't collate information and figures correctly. I think I'm sold to his idea. I think maybe let's hear you on this one. Thirdly, the behavior of these pushbacks that we're talking to, and I think the two provinces that you've mentioned, I'm ashamed to be coming from Mpumalanga. And of course the Free State. And I think our instinct was right as a committee, that, but we're not aware of the extent of some of these things. But does need to be stressed that this is not Italy. We're not having the mafia. We're running a state, and people must behave in a particular way. You know, it's very shameful that these two provinces and all those other ones who have done the things that they were doing, because we're introducing a factor that was absent all along. And at a time when the office of the Auditor General in South Africa is held, you know, in high esteem in the continent and international, and then you have some crooked fellow running some little department in some rural province, thinking they probably know better. I mean, it's just not on. It's something that for me is beyond more than 22 years. More than 20 years in this new constitution, more than 15, 16 years in the PFMA. Surely, we can't do the one step forward, two steps back. We can't. We should be moving dialectically and continuously improving on how we do things. So, I think we've made our position as a committee very clear. The issue of the modified cash standards. I think it all has to do with reluctance to account. You know, people wanting to define how they must account and choosing the simple way out of things. It's the same thing we had with DORA, Department of Health, some times ago, when the department said, once we transfer the money, it's none of our business. We don't have to account. We don't care what they do with it, as long as they've transferred it, which was very wrong. And I do see from one of your comments, and I know that National Treasury deals with a lot of things, and at some point things are bound to fall through the cracks. But I think that if there's one thing they need to be clear of as National Treasury, is that they can't be found to be wanting at any point. Because if they are, then they affect the entire system. So you can't have challenges of interpretation, and it takes a month for National Treasury to come back and have an interpretation. I think because then that uncertainty on their part then emboldens even the departmental official to say, you see, even National Treasury is confused. It's not clear about what it is that must be done. So I think comrades can note that when we meet with National Treasury on compliance with PFMA, we should be able to talk to these things. On the issues of irregular expenditure, I just want to state, AG, that we have resolved to give irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, a special focus. The hearings we're having next week and the week after next are focused not on the annual report, but just on irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure only. Because we were told by National Treasury that departments have procurement plans. They have procurement plans for the whole year, for each quarter. So how do you have emergencies of 9 billion rands in 1 year? How do you have procurement outside, you know, and all those other things that are related to that? So I don't know if you can talk to the PRASA procurement, the irregular expenditure, whether are these technical matters, or as is indeed substantive process deviation, you know, because 9 billion in a year for a board that came in with the mission of solving the what was viewed as the challenges in PRASA, and having made all commitments and gone out to the media to declare their total onslaught on the malfeasance in PRASA, and then to come with a regular expenditure of 9 billion in 1 year. I mean,
is it? Is it just some technical things around maybe they procured when there was no written policy, or there was a policy but it was not signed, therefore technically it's regular, or are these really substantive issues? Just for our and lastly, and I'm taking Comrade Vincent's input as reflecting some level of frustration with being static. Little improvement on getting the basics right. Now, if you have little improvement in just getting the basics, not the further stuff beyond the basics. And I think this is since 2008, if you listen to the governors of the Reserve Bank of America, they've always spoken about the green shoots of the economy, so the economy is growing. But you realize it is more about the desire to see improvement and to egg on economic growth where there is none. And I think the simple reality is that we're not making progress in just getting the basic things right. And I think for me, Comrade Vincent, and I'm sure it's an issue we'll debate, for me, our greatest challenge, you see, because even the public protector thing, which of course does not come here, see, our issue is the lack of responsiveness at the administrative and political level. That then you need a public protector who has enforcement powers, because when issues are raised like the AG is raising, there's no responsiveness. Nothing moves. People even make commitments, but then renege on them. I think that's where our problem is, and we need to acknowledge it. That's where it is. Managers not responsive. The political leadership, whatever their commitment to doing what is right, that commitment is not sufficient to move the administrative leadership to do the right thing. I think that's it. Those are my views, but anyway, AG, let me hand over to you. We've vented.
No, thank you very much, Chair. You know, if I had my way, I would say that your problems are our problems. But the people who are supposed to fix them are not here in the room, but the people who can enforce them is also not us. It's yourselves. And what we bring here is a repetition of the same old... In reality, I just will indulge you, therefore, with the specific questions, but the overall impression coming out of this engagement and past engagements is exactly that and nothing more. There's nothing we can do. I can assure you, Honorable Boy, that scared people run away from pushback. You wouldn't have known about pushback in these accounts if you were scared. Scared people get pushed around and get given all sorts of flamboyant reasons about what happened, and they walk away. We have diligent people, accountants that stand their ground when they know that there's something that is smelly, and they don't run away. So we're not scared. And there's no reason to be, quite frankly, because what are we about? We are about going after people who have been given responsibilities to do that which is desirable to all of us. And sometimes it's itchy when somebody comes after you and say you didn't do it according to how we expect you to. It gets itchy. And when it gets itchy, some of them have got very well-developed schemes to create perceptions of what is actually not the reality. You know, they'll say that now these auditors are this and that and so on, and they start sneaking in messages that suggest that there's something untoward. The reality here is no different to all of these years of this audit that we have done, where when you scratch where it hurts, suddenly you awaken some anger in respect of you digging too deep into areas that are not meant to be your domain. But there's no limitation to an auditor. An auditor audits in an area that is unrestricted as the constitution and the law requires. So we are not going to run away when somebody doesn't produce a document and we see a transfer of a transaction from one account to another. And when we say, where is the evidence for this transaction? And then we get a lot of run around. We don't walk away until we have established exactly what that transaction was about. The one very important instrument that we mustn't lose sight of is that we sign off with a green pen. Nobody else does. So the significance of that responsibility in our hands is what I think we must always be assured that when things happen and the auditors have gone in to look and they come up with these issues, you know, that irregular expenditure is a green pen. Nobody likes it. That's the green pen that must give us assurance that we are still on track. The bottom line is the auditors, in terms of the law of the land, were never given powers to take somebody to task directly and go through the whole value chain. We are part of a bigger value chain that includes yourselves as a scoper. And of course, there are specific responsibilities in law that you, I'm sure, are appreciative of that you need to carry out. So I think, and as we look at where we are now, we should probably also draw attention to that distinction. As far, I'm just trying to deal with a package of the inputs from Honorable Boyd, then I'll go back to the others. As far as the tone is concerned, all I can say is that this tone is not different. It's enhanced from the level where it was before. So it's not a different tone that reflects somebody who's about to give away, to give up. It's a tone that is enhanced towards elevating some of the important issues that are also pertinent in the area of oversight. What happens to these issues once we put them on the table is not in our control, because all we do, we table them and we say, when we interrogate these instruments, these are the things that we are finding. So to me, it's not a different tone. It actually is an enhanced level of engagement from where we were before. And I think that's the commitment we have made, and we continue on that tone. And the suggestion that the model that we are using here is does not talk to the realities on the ground, I'm not too sure what realities are those, but the realities that we are reflecting on in the financial statements are the realities of absence of internal controls and absence of rigor in the financial management discipline. The fact that there are appropriations made to different budgets and so on and so forth, and there's no real change in the experience of the people for whom those budgets were intended, is not the preoccupation of an auditor. So that's probably one of the issues in dealing with the matter of the change on the ground, because we don't impact change on the ground. There are too many things on the ground that can change, and we think that what we are able to surface through these audits is an indication of the things that can shift that ground. If those amounts don't get to the programs that had been budgeted for, the ground will shift. How does it shift? If the monies that were meant to be used towards the repairs and maintenance of water infrastructure are diverted elsewhere, the ground will shift, because there will be no water for people to drink when those pipes are broken. That's part of this reality of financial management issues that we are surfacing. Issues of resistance, by of course they resist these things, because you're scratching where it matters in some instances. There can be no lack of resistance in any audit. Audits are about how strong the people on this side are in ensuring that you deal, not run away from, but deal with these challenges. Hence, we have pushbacks here. So we don't bulk, because we understand the rules. We understand how things must be accounted for. And we think that we deal with people who understand what they need to do and accept immediately, but we also deal with people who resist it. So when they resist it, it's because they want a different outcome sometimes, or they don't understand, or they were caught off guard, or they were expecting somebody else to do this thing for them. And so when they resist, we actually walk through the journey with them, not because of anything, but because we know that for there to be a finality in an audit, the auditor and the auditee must agree. Otherwise, these financial statements, when you look at them in the audit report, they say that these financial statements belong to the entity and they are the responsibility of the accounting officer. We can charge ahead as auditors and sign them, because the owner of these financial statements would not have been on the same page. And I think that's the subtle protocol that operates in an audit. We only always sign after the accounting officer has signed. If you go ahead and sign, what is the value of that? Because the person who's supposed to be owning these financial statements is not owning them, subject to a matter that they are resisting. Is there anything we fear about? In the normal course, you know, people are rattled. People are rattled. I think people are people, you know, they're not machines. They will get rattled when they find extraordinary circumstances when they deal with an audit. It's human. But it doesn't translate to us suppressing what we should have reported because of that resistance. It doesn't translate to that. Otherwise, there will be less and less of the stuff that you are seeing in our report if we are scared. As far as the issue of National Assembly and going to provinces, are you running away from us? No, we're not. It's just that the timing of our diaries allowed us to only be here today, at least at my level, but at least at the level of the other team members in the office. They come here quite often and interact with yourselves. So normally the routine we go through, we go and interact in the provinces and wrap it up at national level while we're preparing ourselves for the final determination of the general report. So our going to the provinces was not running away from anybody. It was just the sequencing of our activities based on the time factor and our other responsibilities. dealing with the issue of the contestations on the audit, I've dealt with it. There are attributable reasons to the pushbacks. I think there are many reasons to the pushbacks, Honorable Boy. And as I said, and you, as you will see in our documentation, I'm the accounting officer and the CFO. At the back of my mind, I've promised somebody during the year that I'm going to ensure that this year I deliver a clean audit. And I've boxed myself in agreeing my performance, that my performance and the reward that arises from my performance will be on the back of achieving, among other things, this goal. When a person gets all manner of things coming from the audit, indicating that all is not going to be well come the finalization of this audit, naturally, they want to protect that position, isn't it? Because for some of them, it might lead, where consequences are attached, it might lead to actions being taken and disciplinary. I read on the other day, just a particular example that I read in the paper, I think it was in yesterday's Business Day, where they reported about the actions that were taken in one of the major public entities as far as the accounting officer is concerned and somebody else in finance who had already been taken to task and have to explain why they should not be suspended. This is not a small thing. And the pushbacks, among other things, also come from people knowing that where there is consequence, there may be these type of actions that follow them. So we see it in that context. Others are also to deflect attention from the real issues that need to be dealt with. So there's a multiple multiplicity of reasons as far as why pushbacks are concentrated the way they are. And I think that it's something that we need to look at. Not from one angle. It's not a mere group of people who do not want to do what's expected. It's because some realize that a lot of the people in the system have woken up to the fact that if you do nothing about these things, they will continue. So when you know that something is going to happen, then your initial defense is to try and push back so that this thing goes away. But we don't let it go away unless it is resolved. That's the point. Coming to your questions, Honorable Smith, and let me deal with the issue of the material misstatements. Let's start from the basics. When we look at the audit of financial statements, there's a long-standing rule in the accounting and auditing discipline that starts from saying that the accounting officer or the entity that is being audited is the primary owner of these financial statements. I'll just use an illustrative example. If I was responsible for 1 million rands to go buy a warehouse, for argument's sake, and there's no other transaction that I'm responsible for, so I've got 1,000 rands, or rather 1 million rands in the bank, and I'm supposed to spend it to buy this warehouse. So for some reason, I decide in my books I'm going to, you know, when you take money out of bank, it's credit bank and debit the asset, right? So you're bringing the asset into your books by substituting it with this 1 million rents that I pay out. So 1 million gone, 1 million worth of a warehouse which I bought in. So in the books I've got a debit and a credit. If because of administrative and other reasons, I decided to post that 1 million rand not to warehouse in the accounts, but to motor vehicles, for argument's sake. That's what you've done as the accounting officer. You put it into motor vehicles instead of putting it into a warehouse, which is what you bought. You made a mistake, or you did something, whether it was a genuine mistake or not a genuine mistake is another issue, but you made a mistake, let's argue. You put it into vehicles. Because you are an accounting officer and you know that you bought a warehouse, I come to you as an auditor and I say, do you realize that when you bought this warehouse, which we went to see, you actually posted it into your books, into motor vehicles? Do you know what's going to happen? When you produce your financial statements, everybody is going to see you no longer have 1 million rands in the books. But your books show a vehicle. But we gave you 1 million rand to go buy a warehouse. That's where the material misstatement issue comes in. However, in the audit, what we say is that in those instances where that has happened, correct this thing by crediting the vehicle where you put it, and show it as a warehouse in your books as well. So that when the person goes out in the field and find a warehouse, they don't get confused when they come to the books and find a vehicle. So the issue of material misstatement comes in that context. So when you adjust it as an accounting officer and take it out of vehicles and put it into warehouse, we then say, because it is so significant, disclose it as a material misstatement that was corrected. And that's why we report it. We say, even though it has subsequently been corrected through the audit, those that are charged with oversight must constantly be aware of instances where adjustments are made at the end, because they are an indication of a weakness in place in the system of financial management. It is not hiding the transaction. It is saying, we have allowed them to correct it, because if they don't correct it, they are going to mislead the person who reads the financial statements. They are going to think that the 1 million rands was spent to buy cars, when in fact it actually bought a warehouse. That's where the issue of material misstatement adjustments comes in, because it also moves from the position that there's an element of accepting that people will be fallible in the course of doing things, but others will be doing it with some ill intent. So to correct it is not a connivance. It's actually a discipline that is not only unique to the private sector, or rather to the public sector. Now let's look at what happens. If they refused to adjust that misstatement, then we say, because you don't want to adjust, we ourselves as auditors are going to draw attention to that matter to the user of the financial statements, hence the qualification. Because if you refuse, then we qualify. To qualify is to draw attention of the user of the financial statements to that circumstance that led to the decision to qualify the financial statements. However, if we correct, if we allow you to correct, your financial statements will be correct, but the fact that you had to process a material adjustment in order to achieve an unqualified position also ought to be known. You were disciplined enough to agree and accept the adjustment, but let's not run away from the fact that these conditions exist in your environment, so that when you come to Scopa, you come to Scopa with an unqualified set of accounts, knowing very well that you still have deficiencies in processing transactions by virtue of the fact that you can allow a transaction of this significance to be processed and only be kept or captured at the tail end of the audit. Otherwise, if it was not for that, all financial statements will be wrong and meaningless, and nobody will know exactly what they are reading if there was no allowance for these misstatements to be processed. Because these financial statements, the people who own them, need to attest to the things they've done with the money. And that's really the context of the financial statements. They are trying to attest to ones, to those that were not given that direct accountability as to what is it that you did when you handled the money. And so both sides, there's transparency to this equation. I'll use an example of this, which is a practical example. I'm sure the members had caught onto some noise regarding the accounts of Tswane towards the end of the year. That's exactly a similar situation, where there was a matter that needed to be disclosed. And the choice was whether we will qualify it so that we draw attention to the user of the financial statements, or management will accept to change it themselves and disclose it. Amounts to the same thing. Either you qualify yourself by yourself, or you get qualified by us. Because when you qualify yourself, you'll disclose and explain all the circumstances you want to explain to those that are charged with oversight of your financial statements. And then the same effect would be felt as if it was qualified by us. Most of them choose to do it themselves because then they will escape the qualification. I guess the issue is, to what extent are these material misstatements given attention by oversight when they arise? To me, that's the question. How do they get dealt with? Because the audit pronounces on them. And I think that maybe the question that we need to extend in terms of this is to say, is there anything that triggers action on the part of oversight to ensure that these practices are nipped in the bud? Consultant and external auditor, and that audits are unqualified with our assistance. The rigor of an audit is about, as I said earlier on, Honorable Smith, is about the auditor being aware of certain systemic and accounting disciplines that promote transparency. It's not consulting to them. It's pointing them to things that they were not aware of. So we don't play the double role of consultant and auditor in that context. Because inherent in an audit, whether it's a private sector audit, whether it's an audit of a major listed entity or a government department, that interaction between the auditor and the auditee is part and parcel of the audit process, to highlight the areas where the auditor, if the auditor didn't account for tax for a major 5 billion transaction, when the auditor highlights the liability for a 500 million tax that did not get accounted for in the books, the auditor is not acting as a consultant in that context. The auditor is acting as an instrument of oversight to bring to the attention of the preparers of financial statements things that are materially incorrect in the financial statements. The one that could be a consultant is when we say we've got additional services that we want to provide you for which we charge. That we don't do. So I wanted to just fix the part that says we double up when we deal with issues of misstatement. It's not consulting to them. It is doing what the role of an auditor is, to point out these deficiencies and issues to an auditee. And so when we surface material misstatements, we don't process it for them. Because if we do that, then we will be taking managerial responsibilities. We just say to them, you've got a 500 million potential liability based on this particular transaction. We think that you have not accounted for tax. Fix it. What's going to happen? You're going to end up with a debit in the income statement or the statement of financial of comprehensive income with tax, and you're going to end up with a liability for tax. If you didn't do it as an auditor, that entire transaction for tax would not have been known to SARS. It's not a consultant. It's an internal control mechanism as part of the combined assurance model that other players play, but the regularity auditor has got a better chance of picking up all these issues consistently as they arise. So the issue of doubling up as a consultant, you can rest assured, we have assured ourselves over time that when we do these audits, we have to do them with a great sense of attention as far as the independence is concerned. Implementing agents and the outsourcing of accountability, I agree with Honorable Smith that this is a matter that needs to be followed up in terms of the committee, you know, at your level, to make sure that this thing doesn't come with outsourcing accountability, because if that other guy who does the implementing part of the work does not have to subject themselves to the same rules that apply to an entity or department, then we may lose the chain of accountability in the system with that. So I agree that it's a real risk that we have. The Chapter 9 institution, what real powers do we have? We have looked at this matter regarding our powers and stuff like that, and can I say that we have reserved a more detailed discussion for this at our standing committee on the AG, but I can perhaps deal with it at a high level because we thought that it belongs there, you know, because that's the committee that deals with us specifically on matters like this. And I think we've got some thoughts that we want to share, which we wish we can find each other with the committee in terms of how do we address this matter going forward. But suffice to say for this purpose, Honorable Smith, that it is desirable that the powers of the AG are looked at in that context, you know, by the people who oversee our activity, so that we can all be on the same page as to where does this thing go. Because as you correctly say, if it's recommend, and then we know that when that recommendation is not carried out, nothing will happen. All of us lose. So I think it's a fair point, the issue about testing the waters as far as where are we now. Because all we know at the moment is that the instrument that guides us, which is the Public Audit Act, says we have a mandate to audit and report. It doesn't go any further. That's the challenge we need to deal with at the level of the standing committee on the AG, at least as a starting point. So I didn't want to spoil that discussion here. At least we can ventilate on it when we engage on it on Friday. I think I've dealt with the issue of the disclosure of irregular expenditure as well as why does that, after you've disclosed, lead to an unqualified position. It's exactly the circumstance I shared where I said the essence of the qualification predominantly is about drawing attention to matters as the independent auditor if the person being audited refuses to. But once they accept the reality that they must, there's no longer a need for the auditor to draw attention to that matter because they've done it themselves. And I keep thinking all situations it's about to what extent is the instrument of oversight diligent in picking up those matters that are directly reported and disclosed by accounting officers in situations where the accounts are unqualified versus the direct path to those matters because they arise as a result of a qualification by the auditor. So there are two extremes in it. The auditee would have agreed to disclose something in terms of irregular expenditure, which means it's already there in the accounts, everybody can see it, but the accounts remained unqualified, versus the auditee refused to disclose this item, which attracted a qualification by the auditor, who then disclosed it themselves. So that's the point I was trying to highlight. But I think the key question is, then how does oversight pick up the matter? Right, I hope I've covered yours, Honorable Smith, and I'm sure if I didn't, I'll come back. Honorable Ross, the issue of the audit outcomes and slide regression. I guess when we look at the issue that we pick up in the slides here, we are referring to the numerical comparison, if you like, you know, the number of departments versus last year and stuff. And if you look at it, it's not a major train smash in that context. But I agree with you, if you look at the substantive issues in terms of which departments are where, and so on and so forth, then your point about perhaps slight regression may not do it is probably makes sense. But I think in the write-up of the general report, all of these matters will be straightened out properly so that we can get a better appreciation of what has regressed majorly as well as versus what has regressed in quantitative terms, as it were. Growing levels of irregular expenditure. Let me talk about the issue that was raised around the irregular expenditure at PRASA. I think members will be aware when we signed off on the accounts of 2013-2014, if I'm not mistaken, yeah, 2013-2014, where we surfaced in our audit of PRASA some elements of supply chain management non-compliance, particularly with the contract that was entered into. One of them was a 51 billion one for rolling stock, and then there was another one for the locomotives and that. So we highlighted issues of irregular expenditure. But let's remember that at the time that we were highlighting the issues of irregular expenditure, the expenditure on the back of the implementation of those programs had not yet hit the books. Remember, they placed orders internationally for all of the things they were buying, and the people in those factories internationally, wherever they bought these things, they were busy building them. So they get built as they deliver. So quite a lot of these actually have been delivered most recently, hence we knew about the big machines that don't fit the bridges and stuff like that. So the payments that were made are what was gone, had gone through the books. So because they are paying against contracts that were found to be irregular, all the payments that are made against those contracts when they come through the books upon receiving the goods and services they got, among other things, is what this irregular expenditure being highlighted is about. The issue about the delivery of supply chain and so on, and the assistance of the procurement office. I think the procurement office has been surfacing quite a lot of issues that they are testing in this area. We are in fact receiving quite frequently now some copy correspondence that the procurement office is sending to various departments. They copy us so that we are aware about the issues. For example, they will request copies of specific contracts from the departments directly. They will send us copies so that we are aware in our audits what sort of issues were given attention by them. You know, so there's now a very open interaction with the procurement office where we share information about all manner of things in this area. And I must say that they are providing quite a lot of oversight work in the background in this area. And I'm sure the committee has looked at a number of reports coming from that office which are looking at the issues about supply chain delivery and so on. Honorable Shulwane, the issues of legal threats and Home Affairs. I mean, Home Affairs is not only this year that was not signed, it also the year before. There were four contracts that were contentious which were contested. We subjected them to the process of trying to resolve differences. We've got a resolution committee that looks at these matters. We even take them to an independent evaluation. But we've stretched ourselves with this one, with Home Affairs. It went right up to an independent arbitrator, you know, after which a conclusion was reached on two issues in their favor, two in our favor, and they still wanted to get to a appeal process, even on the matters that they... And we couldn't understand why is it that we should be getting subjected to such a long and laborious process, because the matters were clarified in a legal dispute. So we worried about this because it starts going beyond the reasonable levels of contestation when it comes to having been taken on some issues of supply chain non-compliance. The effect of this is not only costly to them, it also is costly to us, because in order for us to contest that which is put on the table as a pushback, we also have to engage equally competent people who are unfortunately sometimes senior counsel. And you end up paying from our side a huge amount of legal costs trying to put a defense on this matter. But when you look at the actual outcome of it, it's really a matter of why don't we just adopt the discipline that is being recommended instead of spending all of these monies on this. You know? So we worried what is the intention behind it. And we have seen a trend that is starting to emerge in this context. There was another instance, and even though it was in a local government environment, where a particular municipality, when on the tail end of the audit, when they realized that their audit is falling apart because everything that gets touched is wrong, then they suddenly suggest that, no, give back those financial statements that we gave you, we'll give you another set. And then we say, but how do you do that? Do you keep two accounting records? You know, then they go to court, and then they get an interdict in court that these financial statements must not be released for this or that other reason type stuff. You know, so someone who says, withdraw that which you are finding so many errors in, I'll give you another. he's already suggesting that there obviously is no institution that keeps two sets of accounting records. That's the type of stuff that you are picking up there. And I think you can figure it out for yourselves as to what could be behind something like that. It's either you've prepared the books or you didn't. There's no other set of accounts. That. Otherwise, you must show us the second bank account, because if you don't have it, then you are going to be in trouble. Well, everything is going to change, isn't it?
I'm sure it's not not Bushbuck Rich.
No, no.
Okay.
Right. So it goes with the ones that didn't table in Parliament, because they're supposed to table an annual report, and the annual report must come with audited financial statements. We don't know whether the person doesn't want the issues that are in the financial statements to see the light of day. And that's why we are putting the matter on the table, because we are not scared to put it on the table and say this is what we've picked up here, and we think that those that have got more power to do something about it must act on it. Because in the absence of any act, then this thing just rolls over the following year. Because someone knows that nothing's going to happen to me. Even if I contest and I pay 800,000 rands towards fees, in any case, nobody reviews the financial statements to check why I spent 800,000 on fees that were not budgeted. So it's a mixed bag of things that is not our baby, ultimately. Ours is to put it on the table and let those that deal with it deal with it. That's why, Chair, I was saying that we are really not scared, quite frankly. I want to repeat this so that it is clear that we really are not. I mean, there's nothing to be scared about here. It's just the things that are going wrong which we must report. As far as that, Honorable Silwane, that supply chain management matter on page 23 of the slides for 2.5 billion, it's really a case of where the documents for these supply chain transactions, and you get a run around, and then people get ill, and then they don't come to work, and then they hope that when the time lines run out in the audit, you will be none the wiser. So if you are none the wiser as an auditor in an environment where there is no accountability and consequences, and there's a repetition of the deficiencies in controls, people will do this kind of stuff, because they know that if I don't show this document, no one is going to follow up on it. And I think, again, we are raising this issue because we think that there must be some specific steps taken for those that do not provide documentation, you know, to bring back the whole issue of accountability. I think, Honorable Kekana, the contract management issues that you have highlighted, as well as the supply chain contracting, I think you'll see a lot of evidence of the issues that you are raising in this context in our performance audit reports, the ones I spoke about earlier. But I want to agree with you that there's a huge amount of risk in the low value amounts, the amounts that are below the threshold. Because the amounts that are below the threshold, most of them do not take multiple years to implement. But the difference with them is that they are small but frequent. So if you've got small but frequent, the substantive effect of it almost ends up becoming equal to that 5 million transaction that all of us are trying to focus on, because it's going to be implemented, let's say, over 3 years. Whereas the frequent 499,220 rands, which is below the threshold, you could have those amounts every second day for the whole year, which means that substantively you're dealing with those low-value items which do not attract major attention, but they are many. And I think in supply chain, these are the things that we need to look at to say one of the things that will possibly help here, and maybe you can have a conversation as to how the Office of the Procurement Officer is dealing with it. Because one of the things that they've done, especially if you look at the supply of learning materials, they know that there are a lot of these things that are used in schools which are low in value, but frequent and impactful in terms of value, because there are any thousand number of schools across the country which all need those kind of small value things. And they've started looking at how they can use their mechanisms as the central procurement office to coordinate those things at a central level. I don't know how they are putting that machinery in place, but they've started with learning materials. It may be a good idea to follow up an engagement with them to check whether, in terms of the low value, frequent supply type issues, have they started developing some control mechanisms around them. Because it is true, as you have said, an audit and yourselves will probably be preoccupied with the 316 million transaction type things than those smaller ones which are happening every day. Honorable Kuno, I think you raised the question about how you can we can oversight can improve outcomes for the overall benefit. I thought that comment was directed at committee members. I'm sure you probably are flagging it so that you can continue to reflect on it, how you can improve oversight on the outcomes for the overall benefit of the country. I think that's what you intimated. And the vacancies, if one looks at the stats that we provided, we said that there's a target in the medium-term strategic framework of 10% to 2019, and the current experience is 16 to 20. It is behind that target. However, it is not something that is seriously out of line. At least there's a 2 years to that target. And I guess the path that needs to be traversed forward, I think some of it we'll also be picking up when we look at that key control stuff. Let me just go back to it as well as far as that sentiment is concerned on independence. This key control that we are going to be doing, we're also going to be evaluating issues of vacancies. So if we come to a department or an entity and we find that a CFO or a supply chain person has been out of position for 9 months, those are the things that we will flag to say you're going to fail in your financial management reporting discipline because you don't have the people who will be able to do that work. But the second part of this in terms of the key control response is that when we do this key control, again, it's not a consulting service. It's trying to fill a very clear vacuum that's there. But all we are saying is that we are doing a review. It's a review. It's not a let's help you do your work, as in hold your hand and do your work with you. We are looking at you to say, these are the areas that are often bumpy in your area when you deal with issues of the audits. We know that you haven't had an adjudication committee sitting for the last year, but you've had supply chain transactions in large numbers in the past year. Be aware that if you don't do something to fix that issue, you are going to get trouble in terms of the audit. So it's to that extent that we are making this red flagging intervention in essence, which is pretty much about saying, it will be ideal for everybody to do their accounts and to report transparently every time, but we are not in control of that, as it were. I think I've dealt with all, but Honorable Godi, I think I'm left with your questions now, and perhaps there are two issues, I guess, if I may just finish off on Honorable Kuno's ones, the commitments and the honoring of these commitments and the fact that there's no consequence. I think when commitments are made, and people know that there's something to be achieved in honoring that commitment, whether it is going to lead to a consequence if they didn't honor it or not, it's just a natural discipline. A person wakes up to work, they know that they have the finance department they are running as a CFO. At the end of the last audit, the audit highlighted a number of areas where their accounts are not being properly reconciled or properly reported. Then they commit at the end of the audit when we issue the management letter and they say that we have put in place a mechanism to fix this and they articulate it. If they don't do that which they committed to do, for us as auditors, we're saying that maybe if there was a consequence for not doing it, something would have changed. It goes back to that issue of consequences. Commitments can be made by anyone, and if nothing is done and there's no consequence, we are none the wiser. And the internal control deficiencies, I think if you look at some of the audit outcomes and the pages that are referred to, from the ones that are annotated yellow right down to the purple and the red, those are a variety of instances where internal controls lack, either in the reporting on performance or internal controls for the production of financial information which attracts misstatements, or internal controls where there is non-compliance with prescribed supply chain rules or other areas, including the matter of conflict of interest. By the way, that issue, Honorable Boy, is going to be in the report, the issue about who does business with who. It's just that this report is a report of highlights of the typical issues that you will be preoccupied with. But of course, those issues are not suppressed. as you were indicating. They are not. They are actually in the main report. It's just that we normally highlight issues that we believe for purposes of this briefing, because this document is a high-level briefing. The detail of all of the issues that we have canvassed in the audits and we are reporting on will be contained in the detailed general report. I hear you, Honorable Gordy, regarding the SOEs and more of these having to be audited by the Auditor General. And I think that we hear the voice in this context. However, we have a reality that an audit is a seriously painful exercise to put in place, particularly for those type of entities. And I think as we venture into this path, we will start taking measures properly, because the last thing you want is to assume the responsibilities of a major nightmare, especially for these, not a major nightmare in terms of difficulty, but there are a lot of things that we may not have in place in preparation for getting all of those type of audits in our books. And if you look at the likes of Transnet and all of them, they've predominantly been audited outside of the office in the years when the office did not have the requisite skills and competences to do this work. And that process, because of various other organizational matters, has not really triggered a one-bang change. It's a phased change. I think over the last 6 years, we've basically taken control of entities that were not part of our audits for quite a long time. The likes of your South African Forestry Safcol, the likes of SA Express, the likes of your airports company, SABC, and quite a number of others that we historically did not do. And I think we want to do this in a measured way and also responsibly. Because one other thing as well that we have grown from as an audit office, even though we know that it was a historical consequence of where the office came from, was that the bulk of the support to grow our own talent was also assisted largely by those private audit firms. When we did not have the capacity, they came in to make sure that we meet our reporting obligations. But I think we are busy working in the background to start responding adequately to those expectations so that we don't drop them off one day, because what's going to happen is that if you take them all at one go and we start running into problems in terms of servicing them with the necessary capacity, we may have lost down the way some in serious capacity from those firms. But we do appreciate the points that you are raising in terms of the issues of the standard of reporting, in terms of how this assists your oversight, and we assist with addressing that issue. But we are not walking away from them. I think the issue is to make sure that we do the most responsible thing. But we have seen quite a lot of these state-owned entities, and we also respect the regulatory mechanism that govern them. Some of their founding documents say that the accounting authority at their AGM, which is the board and the shareholders and whatever, must make the decision about these entities. Some of them, you need to enter into discussions with them to understand how to change the audit process. But what's going to complicate it more, Chair, is that within the auditing environment, there's this mandatory audit firm rotation issue that is being debated, which will be, I don't know what the outcome of it is going to be, but it's going to be about dealing with issues of independence from a rotation of auditors' point of view. We don't know how that is going to affect us, and that's why we don't want to make a quick big bang in case we are affected. Our other firms that support us are affected by that reality. So we don't want to collapse this thing because we wanted to do this ourselves. But we are assured that as far as the auditing standards are concerned, much as the formats and the look and feel and presentation of the reports may not be the same, we are comfortable that these audit firms, as they do this, they are adding to the accountability machinery because they comply to the standards that we comply to, but they also subject themselves to our own audit methodology when they do this kind of work. But we will deal with that matter as we go forward in terms of which ones we take. As I said earlier on, we received some correspondence with regards to the future of the audit of SAA, among others. It's not yet in our hands in terms of the decision for it, but I know last week they had an AGM, and we haven't received any formal communication in that regard. So gradually, even that, if one has to consider taking that on, if one recalls the fact that the year-end may be the year-end for March 2017. To take on an audit now without having been part of it in preparation for this coming year-end is a major exercise, because there are not people readily available to assume responsibility for such a big audit. And it's that reality that confronts us whenever we have to think about the next step in terms of the Section 43 audits. The pushbacks, certainly, Chair, you're quite right that we've seen quite a lot of these in Mpumalanga and the Free State, and we have had frank engagements in these provinces, not with the people that we're pushing back, but the ones that they report to, so that we have all of the players on the table, and we put the matters on the table as how we felt and what we thought was behind these pushbacks. And we've now at least got a basis from which to address this matter going forward. It's not a matter we've walked away from. We've said, here are the issues. We're finding an extraordinary set of behaviors that we've never been familiar with when it comes to these audits. And we think that it contaminates the environment in which an audit is done. You better make sure you take your leadership role to fix this matter, because it creates for a bad environment for an audit. So they are on the table as far as these two provinces that you've highlighted. The issues around the modified cash basis, Chair, and the reluctance to account and the fact that you say it's actually at the heart of accountability, I think I agree. But I think there's also an issue about the transparency as well, because this MCS is call this thing that you bought by its name. Don't call it by transfer, because we have no idea what you're transferring to. There are many avenues through which you could transfer, and you have no idea. So all we're calling for is embrace the principle of transparency, which is inherent to the accountability mechanism. That's what that MCS standard is trying to, among others, do. National Treasury role in dealing with these matters. We have prevailed on the Accountant General's office as well on these matters, because some of them, Chair, if you look at the issues that give rise to these pushbacks, are matters that were given consideration in previous years by the Accountant General's office with a view to giving deviation or to give latitude to the departments, because some of the implementation requirements of these change standards go through a phase. You get a exemption, and then once National Treasury gives them an exemption, they then say, in order for this exemption to fly this year and to be able to be ready to account for these transactions next year, I'm giving this exemption to you on condition that you do A, B, C, D in the subsequent year. Most of the time, it's when these departments have not done A, B, C, D on these issues pertaining to the modified cash standard that they fail the audit, and then they start making it an issue of we didn't know, or National Treasury didn't tell us. All sorts of things like those. These are the type of issues also that drive the pushback around the MCS for these entities that you were referring to, among others. I know, for example, environmental affairs is a matter like that. They spent on a couple of projects for expanded public works where there were capital assets that were built in certain areas, and in certain areas were different categories of assets. And they've always budgeted for it like that, and they've always reported on it like that. They were given an exemption to carry on reporting on it like that until that exemption expired this year. But they had not done the things they should have put in place after they had engaged with National Treasury. Hence, they failed the audit in terms of getting a qualification. That's the issue, among other things. Hence, I'm emphasizing the issue of this is also about the transparency and reporting. I agree, Chair, that where there are procurement plans, these issues of emergencies as a reason for deviation from a supply chain is not on, because if there's a procurement plan, then it means that that plan must anticipate the activity effectively. I think that's a correct observation. I've explained the price irregular expenditure context and the lack of responsiveness at administrative and political level. It is largely one of the subset of the reasons behind these audit outcomes. You're quite correct in saying that the lack of responsiveness at administrative and other oversight level is right at the heart of why we where we are. I think I've covered the bulk of the questions, Chair, unless there's anything else I need to cover.
You have covered everything, AG. I can't see the sun. What time is it? All right. If I'm outside,
very easy because I can see the sun and ever since. All right, so I want us to wrap this up. Comrade Boy, Comrade Vincent, and then we call it quits.
So these are quick bites. What you touching?
Right. Sure.
I'm on page 11. Your outstanding audit. I see the 5 audits that remain outstanding since 2014, 2015. Give us a sense what are the challenges, but I don't see where they are and what would have been the problems for such a long time in all what you have deliberated about. What would make you to have of the 26 and then you have left with 5? And I don't see any improvement. You see, in an observation made yesterday when we were dealing with the PMT, Deputy Minister Jeremy Cronin says, you don't have capacity to deal with the 120 billion that the PMT. That's why, as I'm listening with you, in how they try to explain it to us, why they couldn't submit the report of the PMT. Would you comment about that? That's why I'm asking the question of capacity. That is that the challenge? Or the measured approach that you're talking to, the way you're defining it, of how you want to deal with the state-owned companies. I mean, I agree with you, you are measured, but the problem that I don't agree with you is that revenue that gets there or the processes that they're taking in doesn't accommodate the collection of that revenue to assist us to create employment. How do fetter that in into your approach that you're taking? Because if you don't do anything to ESCOM, the woes and things that you see there, how do you convince us? Because they don't go to only you, even ourselves, like, we can't deal with ESCOM. What must we do, you see? And sometimes, because of eagerness of Treasury to resolve some of these challenges, you then find them to use the procurement approach and starting to from where I'm seated, they start creating things that will fasten the approach that you are taking. Is that the issue of capacity? Or just take us through. Okay,
Comrade Vincent, I know the AG is supposed to be somewhere in 10 minutes'
yeah.
time.
So, I agree, Chen. Mine is just to play devil's advocate, AG. You know, I hear your story. I'm going back to this misstatement that you correct. And I accept it. And your argument is that if you don't correct it, the users are going to be misled, because it will be showing as motor vehicles as opposed to warehouse. However, the reality, AG, is that your report comes out 18 months after the fact. And the users of these figures, in the main, are or should be members of parliament in the quarterly reports. So the reality is, for 18 months before you've come to correct it, we still are under the impression that it's for a motor vehicle and not for a warehouse. That's the reality. Now, in the private sector, I accept that 6 months after the end of the year, you do those type of things. But here, that's not the case. The second point that I want to make, Chair, is that the other reality is that, and wrongly so, it's only this committee that really delves into the finances. Because you're saying it's the oversight mechanism that should be delving into these things that have been disclosed. You know, the reality is many other MPs and ministers would say, well, the AG has said it's an unqualified report. Don't even say that, no, but there is an emphasis of matter. They just stick by it's an unqualified report. So I understand the accounting rules. And that is why I'm saying let's play devil's advocate, because 18 months after the fact to come and say to us it was not motor vehicles, it was a warehouse, whereas the portfolio committee and everybody else were under the impression it was a warehouse because you hadn't corrected it, I think is as bad as you not correcting it at the end of the day. I think it's, when I say as bad, I'm saying which is the worst of the evils, because during our in-year, we're looking at it as motor vehicles. It's only 18 months later that we look at it as what it really should be. So that's just the point that I'm saying, Chair, and that is why, personally, I hear what he's saying. Mina, personally, if the accounting officer that gets paid R1 million doesn't know that it's a motor vehicle and puts it into warehouse, then it should be brought up more firmly as an unqualified, as opposed to qualified with emphasis of matter. That's just the point that I'm making, but I concede to your point. And I'm sure that at some level we must debate this thing.
Why? Let me play the angel's advocate and say why. I'm just thinking, maybe you can respond to that. You know, the same thing we're doing with irregular expenditure, where we're saying, give us the details of the irregular expenditure. Is it possible for us to find you at material misstatements? Give us those aspects and those elements that you had to correct, so that we're able to see what is it that was entailed. What is it that they had classified as a motor vehicle when actually it was supposed to be a warehouse? And then we can have a discussion on how is a motor vehicle and a warehouse so similar that you can. I don't know. I'm just thinking. Yeah. Yes, AJ. Is there anything you want to wrap up with?
Yes, Chair, just a few thoughts here. I get the point I just wanted to find Honorable Boys. Oh, yeah, there we go. The outstanding audits and the issue you mentioned specifically regarding the public works and the PMTE. Over the last number of years, public works did not know what assets are in their control. Over a number of years, this is the first attempt that they have made with the introduction of the property management trading entity to bring those assets, many of which they had to spend time finding and making sure they bring onto some asset register. To do that, there had to be a determination of the values that will be put to these assets. And it is when we saw the first part of that in the audit, then tested it and found a number of deficiencies in it. And they took it away and they went to redo some work. So it had very little to do with our capacity. It was them having to go fix the things that were picked up with some valuation methodologies that we needed to test and found deficiencies in it. And the delay in finalizing that audit was largely through that mechanism. And our team has been in touch with them on a regular basis to check and to continue to make sure that you don't bring something onto an asset register with values that might be misleading, because you've used an instrument to determine these values that was never there before. So that delay was largely on the back, not on the back of we didn't have capacity to do a 120 billion valuation. No. It was largely about there are certain areas that we do not agree with on this. Go fix them. And once they are fixed, we'll continue to test this thing to make sure that we are in agreement as far as the numbers shown in the financial statements so that the audit can be concluded. So, can I put it this way? That sentiment that it was because of our lack of capacity is insufficiently exact, if I can put it like that. I wasn't sure about the collection of revenue, but as to what context that came from in terms of, but just in general terms, the extent to which we can assist the system to collect the revenue due to it is to highlight areas of control deficiencies around the debt collection as well as revenue generation. We can't be an instrument in the actual taking money from somebody into the entity's bank account, but at least as far as pointing out things that, I mean, I'll give an example on this issue of revenue collection. When we do local government audits, we give attention to the systems they have in place to raise revenue and to look at whether they do reconcile
to the master files in terms of the electronic systems and all of that. Because what typically happens in revenue generation, if you give me a bill for 1 month for electricity consumption for 120,000, the reality is that I'm going to contest it. It might be that your system doesn't generate transactions from the right source. They might be taking a farmer's ERF number and inadvertently putting it in my household address. And suddenly I'm sitting on my household address because of that electronic environment, which is not strong, with a bill that is supposedly of a commercial nature rather than of a household nature. Those are the issues, I think, that we are limited to focusing on in the area of revenue collection. And lastly, Chair, the issues I think that Honorable Smith has raised regarding there's no doubt that two weaknesses in the system, really. The one is as I've described, but the other one is the follow-up mechanisms in terms of the oversight mechanism. What are the follow-up steps that are in place? And I think we may need to go deeper into what can be done to ensure that these issues around material misstatements are raised. And I can use an example on this one, Honorable Smith, if I use an example of a particular municipality. We arrive at this municipality, they are required to present accounts to the audit committee on the last day of August, which is the day they are submitting financial statements for local government. This was a few years ago in the Eastern Cape. This municipality, because it did not reconcile its records regularly, it allowed a situation where there was what was called a miscellaneous account that was used to transfer all debits. Doesn't matter who bought what where. Now, when you look at this miscellaneous account in detail, you see the likes of transactions like a transaction for 1 million rand exactly, a transaction for 500,000 exactly, another one, a debit in 6 months ago for 1 million 450 exactly. And, of course, there were trips and traps of others that had sense with them in terms of, you know, those transactions. And then the net balance of this miscellaneous account was 75.2 million that they wanted to report as a sundry data, meaning that they are owed by all manner of unidentifiable people 75.2 million, which is sitting in the books. We have a choice. We can allow them to leave it like that and not allow them to make any misstatement, but qualify them. But we have not done our work because we haven't forced them to reconcile that account so that they can put what belongs where, wherever it belongs. Because you'll find that those million transactions and those 400,000 exactly and those 500,000 exactly, these are the type of transactions where, under normal circumstances, you don't get charged an invoice like that. Because things are based on a number of things times a rate of 19.25. It's unlikely to result in amounts with zeros only, especially in a 14% VAT environment. That's the issue. So the issue of identification of misstatements is an inherent risk associated with financial statements, where if you wanted to narrow the space for abuse, you have to identify these things and force them to adjust and see how they react to the adjustment, because the adjustment is going to throw out other things elsewhere. That's how this double entry system has been designed. It makes sure that when you fix this, it pops up elsewhere because it raises other questions. Now, if you don't know what you're doing and you've been dumping things in one account, hiding the fact that, because what happens in reality is that if I'm a soldier in the realm of trying to divert monies from systems, nothing stops me if the guy in the IT department doesn't know what they are doing. Nothing stops me from using my best efforts to inappropriately access the information systems environment and set up accounts which are bogus suppliers with account numbers that belong to me and my other crew. And when the guys in the supply chain process transactions, I also effect those transactions because the segregation of duties in the information systems environment is so compromised that anybody can set up a transaction. If you don't insist on this, they'll get away with it because there's no reconciliations, but all that there is a big dumping account which they know is not going to be touched. It's just going to be left as it is, wrong as it may be. Ultimately, what happened in that account, we were only left with about 385,000 rand that belonged there from 76 million because they had to deal with the fact that certain debits belong elsewhere. Once they get there, those debits, they know there's going to be a further question about what did you buy?
Whereas from this account, nobody's going to ask that question if you don't touch it, if you don't do the adjustment of the misstatement. That is the inherent value that comes from that issue of managing the misstatements that way. Let me leave it at this, Chair, and say thank you very much, and I hope that with this input it will help in getting to this journey that I think all of us agree on, as long as we start identifying what our unique actions must be to reinforce this whole venue. Otherwise, this thing will remain the way it is forever. Thanks.
All right, thanks very much, AG. Comrades, next week, remember, it's Water Affairs, Water Trading Entity, and DERCO on irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And Wednesday, it's military veterans, basic education, CETA, and of course, the Department of Environmental Affairs on their annual report. But the others, now we have requested that they should send us the breakdowns by Friday so that we could have access to the details and be able to try and frame some approach on how to handle it. Right. Auditor General, thanks very much, Mr. Saki. Okay, thanks, comrades. Till next week.